While we're getting going again,
you're back on.
Who all is going to be here all day tomorrow? Who's got to leave sometimes? Either not here tomorrow, has to leave sometime early. Well, what time do you guys have to leave?
Probably leave here about 3
o'clock. Oh, okay. Well, we were going to go until about 3 tomorrow anyway. Okay, so you'll be fine. Who's not going to be here tomorrow? Okay. Okay. One of the things we want to make sure we cover restroom stalls and a door that actually closes. November, December is the best time in the world to really do a what we come to call a renewal list, right? Which is to go through the entire student body and upgrade it. And in a couple of cases, you know, Greg's launching a new leadership program. You're at 200 active students, and here's what the numbers should look like, right? So if I have 200 active students, just use that as a number, right? And some of you have a lot more than that to work with, some of you have less. Is worst case scenario, if you do it right, should be 50% of the student body that you can renew up into the next new program. And best case is in the range of 75 to 80%, right? I mean, we use the Sterling School as a benchmark as doing 87 to 90%, but honestly, that's an outlier, right? So if you manage to get 75% of the student body into something, you'd be hitting it out of the park. And if you did less than 50%, it means you just completely wimped out. I mean, truthfully, and this isn't. Hypothesis, you know, probably 25 years across, you know, 4 to 6 schools, I did this kind of renewal blitz in November, December. And December was always our biggest cash month of the year. Second biggest cash month of the year was November. And oftentimes we would triple what the next biggest month was year to date for that period of time. Does that make sense? And over and over and over again. And then with lots of other schools outside of my own, we've done those numbers a lot of times. And frankly, this is Jeff Smith's idea. It wasn't my idea. I got it from Jeff Smith almost 30 years ago. And part of his language that made it stick with me is he said, well, anytime there's a month that everybody thinks is bad.
Oh, Greg, did we turn this on?
I did.
You did, okay.
Well, we didn't, but you did. Anytime I think there's a month that's going to be bad, I just figure out how to make that the best month. Right? And so obviously he was talking about December. And historically, martial arts schools think December is bad. But see, December is the best month of the year to get people to give you money. Why would that be? They're pulling the credit card out left and right, and they're buying and shopping and going to the mall and everything else, right? I mean, a lot of times retail businesses do what, 50% or more? You know, we're not talking about a grocery store, but I mean clothing stores and different types of stores. They do sometimes as much as half of their business between Thanksgiving and Christmas, right? So it's a time that they're used to spending money, and you can do this with premise A or premise B. Premise A is we have this new exciting program that we're launching. Premise B is we have this program that we've been running. And on January 1st, we have a 20%, 25%, whatever it is, price increase, right? Either way works. Now, when you're launching a new program, guess what? You get to use both. You get to say, we're launching this great new program. It's super exciting. And since you're a longtime loyal student, it's going to cost X. But the real price is X times 1.5 or whatever it is, right? So as a longtime loyal student, as long as you do it by, I'm going to say, what? Somebody have a calendar in front of you? What's the Saturday around December 15th? Is it the 17th, the 15th? What's that?
It
should be
the
20th. Okay, let's say that for grants. It doesn't matter, but that weekend. So as long as you renew by the 20th, you get to save $5,000 on the program. Everybody understand what the premise is, right? And why is the financial savings important? Because there's pain if you don't do it by that date. Because what do a lot of people say that you talk to? That is fantastic. We're going to do it in February. Well, why are you going to do it in February? Well, there's this reason, this reason, this reason, this reason, right? And in almost all cases, it's just they want to give you a good excuse to not do it today, right? And so the answer to that is fairly easy. They say, well, can I do that? Well, of course you can. I just hate to see you pay an extra $5,000. In fact, I hate to see you pay an extra $2,500 a month. I hate to see you pay an extra $750 a week for waiting 7 weeks. What? Well, I mean, it's $5,000 less if you do it now than if you do it February 20th. That translates to almost $1,000 a week for waiting until February to think about it, right? See, I can't just say you save $5,000. I have to really give them the, you know, I really hate to see you pay, you know. Does that make sense?
That's a problem.
Yes.
One of the, I don't like being a pessimist, but what I have problems in my head, maybe it's just in my head, is the fact that my people don't know my price that are not.
Right.
So and it's like a hush-hush. So how do I say it's going to...
But it really isn't the hush-hush.
No, because they know.
They all talk.
They know. Okay. Right. Okay.
It's just they haven't heard it from you.
I'm not asking.
Okay. But what I want to do is make sure we go in-depth A to Z on this, right? And yeah. Simon, you're going to be really the only one in the room that we're going to be missing tomorrow. We're already missing Paul. He had to leave after the West Point trip. What we are going to do, because, see, really, you know, myself, Master Moody, Jeff Smith, all of us working with you guys is no different than you working with your students, right? Because I ended up in 4 conversations last week with different people walking them through how to do the renewal blitz, right? Which really, pretty much everybody in the room needs to do, right? And it's no different than you're working with somebody, teaching them the third form, one-on-one, where you can just teach them in a group and then detail it, right? Now, one of the conversations was one of our peak performers who has 150 students thought that he did the renewal blitz and he knew 3 people. Okay? So how does that fall within those parameters of those numbers? A little out of the range. Greg, you've been around long enough. Do you think there's any exaggeration in those numbers? I mean, you've seen, you were there for some of the, you know, we'd have the Christmas banquets, right? And I would bring a stack of $100 bills. Right. I mean, literally, you know. So
I want to listen.
Okay. Yeah. So he's getting, you know, Simon's getting $1,500 bonus. Here's $1,500 bills, and Al got the new laptop plus the $750 bonus. Right. I mean, that would be every Christmas. But I want to go through that A to Z. And so what we'll get, yes, sir.
Your premise. We've got 200 students. How many of those are already in the leadership program?
Well, no, I'm assuming. In Greg's case, he's got 200. None of them are leaders.
Okay.
Right. So,
would you differentiate between Black Belt Club? Because right now we're about 70% Black Belt Club.
In your case, no. Okay. Because you're launching the next new thing, right?
Yeah. Would you put them in two different? Would you expect the same?
I charge them differently.
Would you expect the same conversion from Black Belt Club, 75% of Black Belt Club members, to code leadership as well as the existing base, or would you say that's a different percentage?
I'd have to know a couple things. The Black Belt Club right now, what has been the premise of the meeting Black Belt Club? What do they receive?
Well, extra classes, but we've got Black Belt Club classes.
Right.
That benefit, plus the...
Yeah, we've got to fix that. That's the time capsule thing.
Yeah.
Right.
And
okay.
The unlimited...
Okay. But how long do they enroll for?
48 months.
So they roll for 48 months to get the first year Black Belt. No, I think you should have the same conversion rate. If anything, those are the ones that are really gung-ho that should be a little easier, right? Now, what will happen with the 25% that aren't Black Belt Club, you'll probably get something like this, which is, so you've got 50 that aren't Black Belt Club, And the 50 that aren't Black Belt Club, it would still be the 50 to 75% range. But then within that, it'll likely be something like 75% into leadership, 25% into Black Belt Club, right? It might be as low as 50-50, although I'd be really surprised, okay? I would expect it to be more like 75 or 80% into leadership. So you do have to factor that in when you're trying to calculate all the numbers, except the good thing is those people are working on the ones that are already, you know, signed up for Black Belt Club a certain amount, because really part of signing them up for leadership is just replacing what they're already committed to, right? So you've got to factor that part out. But what we'll do is we're going to do at least two, maybe three teleconferences between now and the end of the month, to really pull all this stuff together on the leadership program. And we'll probably, maybe the first of November teleconference, try to pull together all the West Point material. And since Don Southerton didn't make it, maybe we replaced Don with Bernard Kara. But we'll try to do a thing with him where he brings a different perspective on West Point as well by teleconference or webinar. But what we'll do is, we're going to be done at 8 tonight. We'll try to get at least an hour of renewal bliss today, and then a pretty good chunk of time tomorrow. Does that make sense? Okay. But let's talk.
Robert, can I ask
yes.
you something? You were asking
of course.
Specifically about the what do you do about the kid people in basic or Black Belt Club and the numbers that are
right.
But we blitz everybody because sure. everybody has something going on. So if they're in the basic program, we want to upgrade the leadership. If they're in Black Belt Club, we want to upgrade the leadership. If they're in leadership and they're paying monthly, we'll offer a discount if they want to pay in full. If they're in leadership and they pay in full, we'll offer them something else, or the instructor program test. If they're a parent, then we'll recommend. I mean, we do everything because if you're going to make this big effort, you can multiply the effort even more. So everybody should have something.
Well, I would even add to that, it's an opportunity to go through the entire student body and review and renew their goals. Right? So even if you have somebody who's paid in full to the highest level program that they can possibly pay for, you don't want to neglect them either. Right? So most of the premise of the renewal bliss is an intense focus on goal setting, commitment, and achievement. Right? It's not, most of it, a very small amount is about you're going to save money and you should do it now. Right? Now,
and it makes perfect sense to do that at the end of the year, by the way, right?
Right.
Because now you're starting the next, we're getting ready to start the next year up right.
Right.
And because we're doing that, we need to do, you know, we need to set everybody in goals for what's going to happen. And that's realistic. That's real. It's not just BS for sales.
Well, again, think of the two sides. From a student side, finishing the year with reviewing, renewing, and committing to their goals is a very important way to go into 2015. Would everybody agree with that? On the other hand, from a purely business standpoint, sucking up as much cash as you can possibly do, and at the same time getting as big of a bump in the billing to start in 2015 if you can, accomplishes a lot of objectives. Okay? And I got to tell you, over 25 years, I've had years where it was $200,000 in debt that needed to be liquidated, and there was going to be a problem. And I've also had years where it was I wanted to do $100,000 in advertising in January, and this is the way to generate the extra cash. And other years where it was, it'd be nice to, you know, buy a new Rolex and go on a trip and not have to worry about it and start with, an extra big savings account the first year to go into the new year, right? And so regardless of where you're at, right, if you have real solid cash flow, it may be your excuse is generate cash for a marketing budget to add 100 students or add 300 students or add 400 students, right? Because anytime I've done a big blitz, and by the way, the best time to do advertising is January, right? The worst time, by the way, is November, December, right? And what's the number one reason for that? Everybody else who spends big bucks in advertising by media is doing it in November, December, right? If you're in their mailbox, they're getting 10 catalogs in your envelope, right? And if you're buying TV, everybody's buying, you know, the Black Friday sale ad and so forth. So the hardest time to buy media, and that includes direct mail, is November, December. Direct mail only because there's super high volume of mail, the number of things in their mailboxes, so your response rate goes down, plus they're distracted. But the best time is first of the year, right, for us. And best time for the fitness industry, best time for adult martial arts, best time for kid martial arts. So, but again, regardless of what the premise is, it can be going into the new year with a big marketing budget, it can be going into the new year with a bunch of savings, or it can be going into the new year fixing a bunch of problems that have happened this year, and I need to clean up the year before I go in, right? I don't want to carry the problem from the new year, I want to finish the year off strong, right? Doesn't matter how well you're doing, you're going to have years where all three of those are true, right? So it's just fine. But let's shift back before we go into all of this stuff in detail. Did everybody enjoy Commissioner Parrott's presentation?
Very much.
What I wanted to talk to you about first, and there's a lot of lessons, some of which he didn't talk about very much. But let's talk about the first lesson. How do you end up with people like that accessible to you? See, I've had a lot of people say, well, you know all these famous people, and you get them to do stuff for you, and how can you possibly afford to do stuff? I mean, we've had Tony Robbins do things. We've had Brian Tracy. We had Brian Tracy as a speaker at an event. We had Dan Kennedy as a speaker at an event. I've had Chuck Norris do stuff for me. Guess how much I paid any one of them? Zero. Right? And see, the problem would have been, to get Chuck to do what he did, it would have been write a check for $50,000. Right? That was his fee for doing what it did. And I don't think he has a fee now. I mean, he has to talk to his wife, and she said no. That's basically, you know, what happened with Chuck. You got to talk to Gina. What's Gina's answer? No. I'm serious. I mean, if there's maybe a major movie calling and they got a $50,000 budget, she might let him talk to him. Other than that, Gina says no. That's Chuck's deal nowadays, right? But let's talk about networking for a second. I think it's useful and important, right? Yeah. Who else in here has had some good experiences and some opportunities to network with some useful, powerful, famous, or worthwhile people? Anybody had some good success stories in the past? No? Okay, I'll talk about my success stories. The first part of being effective, I think, at networking is to not be afraid to do it, right? And that's, I think, the biggest piece that a lot of times people miss, right, is they're just afraid to ask. And so part of it is getting out of your comfort zone and being aware of opportunities. Now, none of the ones that I just mentioned fit this scenario, but there's a whole list of other people that I've ended up meeting, working with, getting ideas from. You know, one of them is your father-in-law, right? So his father-in-law was the president of a $680 million electronics chain, right? Turned out that it was his two daughters enrolled as students, and at one time we had, I think, the three top executives. We had the chief operations officer, Neil Bobrick. We had the sales manager,
John Collier,
yeah. And the president of the company all had enrolled their kids, right? Well, would that have done me any good at all? And again, this is, you know, we were running, I think, six schools at the time, and it was just out of one of the schools. Would that have done me any good at all if I hadn't ever figured out who they were? See, that was the first thing, right? And I got to tell you, all of us have that problem, is a lot of times you enroll people who would be either very interesting to network with, or they could really contribute to your business, or you have some other business objectives they can contribute to, or just like we talked about, president of the PTO, PTA, the person who's in charge of the Boy Scouts citywide, something like that, and you just don't find out enough about your students to know who they are, right? And in a lot of cases, they'd be happy to help. They just don't know that they could be useful for you, right? I mean, don't expect somebody who's in the right position to do a lot for you to jump to the conclusion on their own. Does that make sense? And like in Workman's case, we did a deal one time where he put, it was about a half a page in a flyer insert they did into the two major newspapers in town. And one had a circulation, I think, of 850,000. The other had a circulation of about 750,000. And they would do a full color, what was it, 16-page insert in the newspaper. And it really came about, we were talking about something at our black belt test, and I was talking about a promotion we were doing, and he heard me. And he approached me, he said, "What would you like to do that with us?" Yeah, that might be a good idea. And at the time they had, what, 12 stores in Denver, more or less? But 12, like 70,000 square foot electronic stores, right? So they did an ad for us that was half page in their insert into the newspapers. Let us set up a booth in all of their stores. Did a certificate where anybody who bought $1,000 or more transaction in their stores, and by the way, it was hard to go in and out of one of their stores unless you're buying a cable for less than $1,000, right? Because they were doing high-end TVs and high-end stereos and car stereos, all that stuff, right? So anybody who did more than $1,000, they gave them a certificate. That was a real nice printed certificate for 1 month of lessons and a free uniform. They let us set up booths in the lobby for a full 3-day weekend. They advertised that we were going to be at all their stores for a full three-day weekend. Advertised a certificate as one more excuse to come in and buy from them that weekend. Guess how much that cost me? Zero. And they were doing it all already, so us giving them certificate was a benefit for them, right? And it was a huge benefit for us, because guess what? Their stores did much traffic, right? We got not only good exposure, but we got a bunch of appointments that weekend, right? Now, so the first thing with networking is just constantly being aware of who you already know, you just don't know them very well, right? Like you've got the senator. God knows how many people he knows, right? But just be aware of how many people you have already. Be aware of who they are. And then start to get to know. In fact, there was I'm reading an interesting book called Data Apocalypse. Yeah. But basically, it's a gentleman who's examining big data and looking at Google's numbers. He's one of the founders of OkCupid, so he's looking at, you know, aggregate data from there. But one of the comments he made is that, you know, the old thing, you know, the seven degrees of separation, Kevin Bacon and so forth, he said one of the things they did with the data is they figured out not only is that accurate, but it's actually a step shorter, that everybody has 6 degrees of separation between them and anybody in the world, right? So if you look at that and look at all the people you already know and have as students, number one, a whole bunch of them are in positions doing things that could be useful for you and you don't even know it, right? We had the HR director for US West, which is now, I don't know what the hell it is, but it was one of the baby bells. Well, in the Denver metropolitan area, they had 47,000 employees. Well, now, once we figured out that we had the human resource director for a company that big, there's all kinds of stuff we could do, right? We ended up at company functions for free, doing all kinds of stuff, able to do booths and so forth. They did payroll stuffers for us. So they would print a payroll stuffer, giving a coupon to our school, to all of them, with a percentage discount, right? Guess what the biggest barrier was to getting all that to happen? Knowing that guy was the HR director for the baby belt. Until we asked and knew what was going on, we couldn't have accomplished anything, right? And so that's the first thing is get listening systems in place. You know, in my case, again, with multiple schools, if you have a single school, it's easier than with multiple schools to do that. But I was always taking key checkpoints, and for a while I was doing all the bell tests for all the schools. But meeting people, asking what they did, but probably more important is every staff meeting, just asking, well, who have we enrolled, or any of them do anything interesting, you know, what's going on? And that way I was finding out, well, we just enrolled you know, this pro football player. We just enrolled this guy. We had the former CEO of what was Norwest Bank, which became part of Wells Fargo, right? So we had the CEO of that chain. We also had the grandkids I mentioned before, Marvin Davis' grandkids. We never managed to pull that off. Hell, we could barely get the mother in, much less Marvin Davis. But all kinds of people like that, just from paying attention and listening, and then taking the next step of just figuring out what might be useful. Now listen to this, this is important. For them. See, not figuring out what was going to be useful for me. Figuring out what was going to be useful for them. Okay? And I can't tell you how many times over the years that I've had somebody who's like the CEO of a big company or they're a partner in a law firm or something, and all of a sudden they're trying to take me up for lunch, trying to figure out how he has such a dynamic, charismatic, exciting staff. Right? Because they just had never seen that before. So, now, and by the way, what was I thinking? Are you freaking kidding me? Yeah, right? I mean, you know, I mean, there's always two perspectives of what's going on, right? There's the employer perspective of, okay, I got one good one and six bums. How do I get rid of this six bums, right? I mean, there were periods like that. But you've got to know who they are, have listening systems so you figure it out, and then figure it out what's in it for them. So like most of those like big names that I mentioned, the way I developed, you know, a pretty good friendship, I mean, the way I ended up with Chuck Norris's phone and then cell phone number and ended up at his ranch and doing a whole bunch of other stuff, is figuring out what can I do to help him, right? And, you know, in the case of Chuck, it was, the first round was the Sidekicks movie. And when it came out, I did more for him in Denver than everybody else in all the other cities put together, plus lined up some other cities like that. So that once they knew I was in the loop, all of a sudden their results tripled, right? So it's always figuring out what's in it for them, right? Because guess what? Anybody who's rich, famous, in a position of authority, what do they get all the time? People are trying to get them to do something. People are trying to sell them something. People are gravitating to them because of their celebrity, right? And what do they have around them? Gatekeepers. So they have gatekeepers around them designed to keep the leeches from getting to them and keep the salespeople from getting to them, right? But if you can go at it the other way, figure out who you are, be listening to what's going on, figure out what you can do for them, you know, and then drop ideas on them, right? Now, is it unusual to be around sharp, intelligent people who are, when they're talking to you, saying, hey, I had a thought. Would it be helpful if we did this in what you're trying to accomplish? Would it be helpful if we had this resource? Is that normal or is that unusual? See, that's really unusual, right? I mean, how many people do you have? And the Christ School is a little bit of an anomaly, but do you have a lot of people who are coming up to you like that on a daily basis? Right? I mean, even when you're in the karate school, you have an awful lot of parents who are having all kinds of great ideas for how you can sell their thing, how you can help them with their deal, right? But there's not a lot of them that are coming up to you with great ideas on how you can help. Does that make sense? So I would say the first thing is to get really aware of what's in your student body. Really pay attention and listen to what they're engaged in. The idea you were talking about yesterday, Greg, is one of those first steps. Everybody goes and talks to everybody, right? The instructor has to talk to four people this class. Well, one of the questions to ask is every new student, what do you do? What does dad do? How did you end up, you know, are you from Denver, New York, or whatever? How did you end up here, right? We had at one time never figured out something. Well, we had the five-state director for McDonald's, whose kid got their black belt, and ended up on the board of directors for McDonald's, ended up moving to Chicago and one thing or another. And then we also had the person who worked for McDonald's when they absorbed Chipotle. Now, I don't know if you know that story, but you're familiar with Chipotle, right? Mm-hmm. Well, Chipotle was founded right across from where I got my MBA. That was the first location. They were at, I don't know, five or six locations when McDonald's absorbed them. and grew it under McDonald's shell to, I think, 450 or 500 locations. And then they spun it off. It may have been more than that, but that it was under McDonald's tutelage. They grew it to, I don't know, like I said, 400, 500, 600 locations. And now it's a freestanding company again, right? But the guy who was from McDonald's doing that was one of our students. Now, there might have been some interesting things we could pull off with him. I never figured out what it was at the time. And keep in mind, at the time, Chipotle had like 3 or 4 locations, right? But, you know, I could go on and on and on with stories like that, right? You know, Carl Mecklenburg, who was a, I don't know, 4 or 5-time Pro Bowler, played in 2 Super Bowls, is you know, on the list for Football Hall of Fame. We had him speak at one of our events. You know, I'm trying to remember how I met him, but basically it was he did a book, and then I ended up calling him and talking to him. Took him out to lunch, I think. And then all of the conversation was, it's called The Heart of a Student Athlete. All the conversation was, well, hell, what can we do to help you promote the book? It's really good. I mean, it's exactly who we're dealing with. We're dealing with public schools, we're dealing with private schools. That's our age group. What can we do to help you promote your book, right? You know, among other things, the outcome was he ended up coming and speaking to us. What did it cost to buy him a plane ticket? I mean, that was it, right? But it's again, figure out what you can do for them, focus exclusively on outcomes for them, and then that comes back around, right? And in most cases, it comes back around without you even having to ask, right? And other times, it's you think of something that isn't going to be a big deal for them to do, but would be extremely useful for you. Right? We had Brian Tracy come speak at our event for free. Well, do you know what the number one criteria was for figuring out how to get Brian Tracy? You know what it was? We held the event in San Diego.
Oh, didn't
have to go. He lives in San Diego, right? And when we put the event in San Diego, my short list was Dennis Whaley and Brian Tracy because they both live in San Diego, right? So I was going to be okay with either one. Right. I was working on Zig, by the way, but then he fell down the stairs. My short list with it was Zig or Chuck, because we were going to do Dallas, and they both live in Dallas. But then Zig fell down the stairs, and Chuck got married, and you know. Well, anyway, because you know you have to go through Gina. Gina says no, right? So I've actually gotten Chuck to do some stuff since he got married, but you know it's few and far between. Nowadays. But does this all make sense, right? But when you think about networking with people, is most of it starts internally with who you have already, right? Because you all have some pretty interesting people in your school already. You just may not know it yet. Then talk about that 6 degrees of separation. The next question is always, who do they know? Right? Because there's always then the next step of you know this person and they're really exciting really enthusiastic about you. And even if this particular person, you can't come up with anything in their career that they do, you never know who they know. Right? I mean, the old marketing axiom is the customer you pissed off last week always lives next door to the guy who you've been trying to, you know, seal a $2 or $3 million contract with. But the reverse goes as well, right? Is the excited student that you have may just have uncle, aunt, sister, brother, next door neighbor that can do something extremely useful for you, right? Yes, sir.
And you just approach them about, hey, you know, can you schedule a meeting and say, what can we do to promote whatever you're doing? Or?
Well, see, I think a lot of it, you know, it's a little bit of a tangent, but, you know, think about what Commissioner Carrick was saying, right? Is if it starts with everyone in the school knows what your mission is, right? And by the way, your mission isn't to make as much money as possible and buy a new Ferrari. Okay? It's okay for that to be a goal of yours. But that's not the mission, right? And I got to tell you what, even for yourself, you know, the goal, make more money, buy a Ferrari, really or facetiously, right, is even for yourself, that doesn't drive you very strong. Does that make sense? I mean, we should all be motivated by stuff and by money and by one thing or another, but the reality is there's got to be something more exciting than that, right? You know, for me, if it had been make more money and buy a Ferrari, which I want to do both, right? But if it had been make more money, buy a Ferrari, although my new Mercedes is faster than most of the Ferraris. But anyway, if that had been the only thing, there would have been a lot of other industries where I could have done that more efficiently and would have jumped 20-some years ago, right? I was always being offered commercial loan broker, you know, commercial real estate broker, developers, I mean, all kinds of different things. That's just all real estate related. But to me, it was about the mission that had to include this, but wasn't exclusive to that. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And this was more empowering, but more important. And I think that's especially true with what we do, right? I can think of a lot, and maybe this is my own frame of reference, I can think of most industries that I go, eh, so what, right? So what, I'm a real estate agent, and I help that guy buy that house that he found online, and I helped him with the contract, right? I mean, how many other people do that? Could I make a lot of money doing that? Sure. Okay, I went and found this house, flipped it. Well, okay, but so what, right? But what we do is life-changing, empowering for people, right? But this, it's got to be that with your students, right? If you don't have all the staff bought into the mission and all the students bought into the mission, then this stuff just, and probably is, manipulative. But if you have everybody bought into the mission of what you're trying to accomplish, this becomes their eager and enthusiastic to help you accomplish your mission. In part because of reciprocity, in part because they're so enthusiastic. Does that make sense? So that's really where it comes from, right? And again, I see a lot of people muck this up. They go try to like barter, and then you end up with, you know, like a movie theater rental, and you know, it's not hard to get into the movie theater. You just send National Cinema Media a check for $150 and you got a booth, right? But that's not, you know, that's not helping you very much. It's all this stuff that gets you, you know, leapfrogging. Does that make sense? And again, you heard his story. He jumped like, you know, I don't know, 52 levels. How did he jump 52 levels? Well, part of it was confidence, and part of it was relationship, right? If Rudy Giuliani didn't first like him and then trust him and then, you know, have a high expectation in his competencies, he never would have said, go fix Rikers Island. And if he had never said, go fix Rikers Island, you know, 30 years later, he could have been bubbling up towards the top of the police department. But instead, it jumped a whole bunch of steps and then it jumped a whole bunch of steps to get there. Does that make sense? But when it's so most of your networking opportunities, most of your opportunities comes from your existing student body, right? The other thing I'll tell you is we are all in a unique situation. When I was doing those Dan Kennedy Platinum meetings, which was the top 0.1% of his clientele, is I used to get questions all the time. Well, wait a minute, you just like, they're trying to get celebrities and so forth, and they're like, well, you just got the world champion kickboxer doing your stuff. How did you get that to happen? I grew up with him. I mean, it's, you know, it's not like I went and hired him. You know, I didn't go pay him $100,000 to use his name. It just, you know, relationship. And then it's like, well, you just got Chuck Norris to do something. What, you know, how do we contact his agent and what do we pay him? I said, well, we're friends. I just kind of did stuff for you. I mean, it would be like none of them understood the dynamic, right? And even somebody like Brian Tracy or even Dan, you know, if you had mentioned it in the meeting, Dan would have never claimed that he would have come done the stuff for us for free, right? Never would have said it, right? But you know, they were all shocked that we ended up with all that stuff. But we all have a unique advantage, right? If how many famous people are that do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, right? The guy from Married with Family, Married with Kids?
Children.
What's his name?
Married with Children.
Ed O'Neill.
Ed O'Neill. You got Ed O'Neill, and you've got, you could probably come up with 10 celebrities who are doing precision jiu-jitsu, what or so. Rob, you got Jennifer Lopez, you can
Ashton
go this. What's that?
Ashton
Kutcher. Who else?
Sean Patrick Landry.
Yeah. Well, the guy who made that belt, a red belt movie, is a big aficionado. Who else? Come up with
Tom
some more.
Walker.
Tom Walker.
Paul Walker.
Paul Walker. Too late now. Yeah, by all accounts, he was a great guy, right? He died. They wrapped a Porsche Carrera around a phone call, right? A friend of mine died the same way. His name was Corey Rugel. He was an internet marketing a genius, and he died. The Porsche Carreras apparently had some stability issues, right? So that was the $500,000 kind of limited edition that had that looked kind of like a Ferrari in the back end with the. But Paul Walker and Corey both died in a Porsche Carrera. Both as passengers. We're not talking about 911. We're talking about the high end race car. In Corey's case, they were test driving it because he wanted to buy it. He was in the car. They were on a track, but they were taking it for a spin because he was looking to buy the car. But from a connecting with rich and famous people standpoint, we have an advantage because we have the affiliation of martial arts that transcends and is easier to connect with than almost anything else, right? And I'm sure there's other arenas. There's the guy who's the soccer player, and there's the guy who's I'm sure in other arenas it probably works in similar ways. But we seem to have a unique relationship with the art, right? How did I end up being good friends with Bernie? He's 53 black belt, right? I mean, it's all about martial arts, right? He's a fan of Jeff Smith. He grew up watching Jeff Smith kick Kareem Allah's ass and all that stuff, and he was more excited to meet Jeff, right, than anything else. I mean, it was like, I get to meet my high school, my high school idol, oh my goodness, right? And it was really interesting. He was also talking, it's kind of interesting, about like being a famous person, meeting famous people. He said he's talking about meeting James Woods. And he said it's really weird because like he knew who I was and I knew who he was, but we didn't know each other and he wanted to meet me and like I wanted to meet him. It was kind of cool. But he says it's a weird dynamic of, what are you going to do? Go introduce yourself. Hi, you know me, I know you, but is this making some sense, right? And if it's trying to connect with rich, famous, CEO, whatever it is, the first thing is just not being shy about it, because most people are just too timid to like go talk to them or go build a relationship, right? But then it has second to do with like listening to what they're trying to accomplish and figuring out if there's anything in your arena that you can do to help, right? And a lot of times there's more than you think there is. In their microcosm, the guy may be making, $7 million a year, but there's a niche where you could really help them out, right? And so, like in our conversation with Commissioner Carrick, the number one thing that came up that we could all do to help him out? When the book comes out, if in key bookstores, if a whole bunch of them got bought at the right bookstores all over the country, that zooms in up the New York Times bestseller list, and then that has a snowball effect, right? So the number one thing that like we could do to help him is March 1st or April 17th, whatever day it comes out, is send a whole bunch of people out to the targeted Barnes & Noble and whichever bookstore it is to go buy the book so it gets on the New York Times bestseller list, which does what? Gets in more media, gets it more play, gets it up on the top of the Amazon list, everything else, right? Well, now I've cataloged that. So what are we all going to be doing, in April? We're going to make his book a bestseller. Why? Well, he's a friend. And he's a martial artist, but guess what? Comes around, goes around, right? There's all those different other opportunities that go with it. Does that make sense? So when it comes rich and famous, a lot of times what you'll find is you'll be at the right place, wrong, right time, and then just be shy or timid about talking to the person, right? And I'm not talking about, oh, let's go get an autograph, and can I get your, you know, I'm not talking about being a fan, right? And by the way, people like that you want to network with, the worst thing you do is be a fan, right? Because they put that in a different category. Doesn't mean you're not appreciative of what they do. Who's the singer that's friends with Chuck Norris? Country Western singer, Randy Travis. I remember when we met Randy Travis, and he's a friend of Chuck's, and he was going around with the WCL thing. And, you know, it's one of those interesting things, because again, it's like, you know who he is, but you don't want to be like, hey, let's do all that. So we were having a conversation somewhere in there. I said, you know, not much of a country fan, but I like your music, and I really appreciate you being here to support Chuck, because he's trying to get this thing off and running. And then it's like, well, what do you do? And I said, well, I do support martial arts schools around the country, and we're trying to help him get this thing going. And then it takes it out on a completely different plane, and you're just like the fan. Does that make sense? So when it comes to that, you know, first is, remember, you have affiliation with many via martial arts. And by the way, Brian Tracy is a black belt, right? Brian Tracy at one point ran a martial arts school. And, you know, the crazy interesting story, by the way, can anybody guess how I first met Brian Tracy? This is a weird story. We met the guy that goes from city to city to city to pitch Brian's seminars. His name was Steve Black, I think. So we meet the guy who goes from city to city to city pitching, and basically what it would be is the guy goes into Denver and he goes and does sales presentations at all real estate offices and all the different offices and so forth. And we get a call wanting him to do something, and, you know, says sure, but then built a relationship with him. And somewhere along the thing, it's like, well, you know, the seminar is on Thursday. And I said to him, well, who's picking Brian up at the airport? He said, oh, damn, I always have to do that. I said, we'll volunteer. You know, we'll go pick him up at the airport. And so we went and picked him up at the airport. And then we started talking. And there was a new book that I had just read called Making the Corps about the Marine Corps boot camp. And I mentioned that because it was relevant to the conversation. He goes, I haven't read that one yet, but I should read that one. So we went to the seminar the next day, and I made sure I brought one for him and gave him the Making the Corps book. And then, you know, kudos to Brian. About 2 weeks later, I get a couple of his books signed and a personal thing, and you're such a great guy, and, you know, thank you so much. But then that was just enough to crack the code to have a little bit of relationship. Does that make sense? But it all started with, like, you know, this guy met, you know, probably 100 different companies, and most of them watched him come and go, and we built a little bit of rapport with him and took him out to dinner. And then just Don and I volunteered to pick him up at the airport and then built a little bit of a relationship with Brian, right? But it's that type of thing. And, of course, the conversation was, hey, Brian, you're a black belt. How long has it been since you trained? And, you know, where did you train? And, oh, you ran a school? I didn't even know you ran a school. And, you know, when was that? I mean, that was all part of the conversation, so all the martial arts tied in. But is this making sense? And it's a topic that merits a lot of awareness, because so many times we're leaving opportunity on the table all around us, right? And it's, you know, Jay Abraham's comment is that most people have a lot more money just laying around the floor of their business that they don't have a dollar to pick up than they're actually making. But it's all these types of things that can skyrocket, right? You know, we've gotten a lot of TV over the years, but I mean, over the years we enrolled like the weatherman's son in classes and one of the other anchors' kids in classes, and we had the cameraman for Channel 9.
Jumping for RESP, right?
Who was?
The drummer for REO Speedwagon.
Was he?
Yeah.
I don't remember that one. I didn't know that. Or maybe I forgot. What's his name? Do you remember? We had the drummer for REO Speedwagon. Well, we also had the promotional director for the CFO for the Denver Broncos, and we had a promotional director for the Nuggets. And we had the owners of Larry's Flowers. We had the owners of Mile High Office Supply. We had the owners of Colorado, New Mexico, Paul Mitchell Distributorship.
The founders of Einstein Bagels.
Yeah, I remember that one. One of the founders of Einstein Bagels. And we had one of the key executives for Rock Bottom, Old Chicago, for that restaurant chain. But I mean, you start hearing this list, and you know, if we had enough of us in the room, we could think of a lot more of those. Some of them turned into like home runs. Others turned into just like good networking opportunity. Others, it was just something in the back of their mind that may or may not have turned into something I perhaps don't even know, right? But the more you're aware of that, and the more you work on it, but the more you continue to think of, you know, what's in it for them, what can I do, and how can I just be sincere and legitimate, right? Some of them end up, you know, like Jan and Robert, who were the Paul Mitchell Distributorship. I mean, we ended up meeting John Paul DiGiorgio, and actually it was the opposite way around. Ended up meeting them through the Paul Mitchell martial arts team. But, you know, ended up meeting all kinds of interesting people. When we went to Visible Changes, hair salon in Houston, John McCormick I met through Robert and Janet Stafford, who I met through the Paul Mitchell martial arts team, whose kids ended up, one of them a black belt, one of them got to like red belt before this. You know, I mean, see how you get to all those different relationships if you just explore and are aware and pay attention. Does that make sense? Questions or thoughts on that? Does it make sense to you? Like, I mean, where DC Krav Maga is, there's a ton of people in there that can do a bunch of stuff for you. You just got to know who they are, right? And certainly, Eric and High, you have a bunch of them in your school. And are you guys pretty aware of what people do and so forth, and good at trying to have a relationship?
And that, even on the lower end, that still helps you when you're speaking of your leadership and such, because you know what the clients do.
Right.
What's important to them, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And, well, that's right. You know what they do. You know what's important to them. And you should be doing as much of this as you can, even if you can't come up with anything that ultimately might come back to you, right? I mean, I've always done the, I'm looking for a job, bring me your resume, what is it you're looking to do? Oh, you're doing this, we know this guy, might that be helpful? I mean, we've always done that just as a natural, you know, course of interacting with people, right? So the more you can be in the mode of what can I do for you, short of buying into every MLM deal that comes across the table, right? Because that's usually the first thing, you know. Well, I'm, yeah, okay. Yeah. Other than that, you know, what else can we do? Although even those, you know, I've gone and done motivational speaking for a lot of those guys, even though they had no interest and they were doing anything, you know. I've done rallies of, you know, a few hundred people all the way down to 20 or 30 just to help them out. But I had no interest in, you know, being in the downlines, right? So
I thought of something that was going to run by you, see if it was a good idea as far as networking goes. I was thinking of putting an LED, like a cheap TV up,
right,
and just putting those zip drives on it and just promoting it all the parents. Well, if you have a business or just whatever,
right,
you want to scroll something through, do that, and then use that kind of as a starting platform for doing some networking through that.
I don't think it hurts in any way, right? Whether it in and of itself is going to, you know, have any kind of measurable impact, I don't know. You know, we've tried over the years all kinds of different iterations of that. Here's a bunch of business card holders, put your business card up to, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's ultimately, I think, like the retention conversation, which is there's no way around. It's all about personal relationship, right? So when you're sitting there with them saying, you know, what do? Fantastic. You know, is there anything we can do to help? You know, and it's, you know, a lot of them are in some kind of career where there's, it's a stretch to think of something that we could possibly do. You know, I'm a government geologist and I do this and that. I mean, I don't know what we could do to help. But the more you're listening and the more you come up with stuff, I mean, even just offering to make the connection because he's looking for a career transition and this guy might be able to help, all that stuff goes a long way, right? what I think would be good about that is it puts the, you know, puts the idea in people's mind, right? Now, I'd rather it be, here's a picture of Joey, here's the parents. Dad is number one REMAX realtor in the state. You know, if you need anything, right? I make it as personal as you can possibly make, right? So, you know, here's Billy. Dad's run, you know, Louie's Pizzeria down on 32nd. It's our favorite pizzeria. You know, you see what I'm saying? The more personal you make it, the better off you're going to be. And even in the classroom environment. Hey, we want to recognize, you know, Joe Lucero. You know, this is their third year in business at you know, Luigi's Pizzeria. Guys, if you haven't been there, you really need to go. And by the way, hey, I heard they can do birthday parties and stuff like that. You know, just that kind of stuff. So whether it's electronic or on the walls or whatever, the more personal you make it, and the more you make it about this is Susie's dad, rather than it's a generic business, I think the more powerful it'll be. And none of it replaces having a conversation with people, just saying, we're going to do the cover. Right? But anything to add or any questions on that?
The only thing I'd have is if you're discouraged about that, you know, you don't know anybody or it's not coming to the top of your head, but there's somebody, if you really think about it, for every 100 students, 5 of them are in the top 5% of whatever, you know, statistically. Right. Statistically, it would make sense you have the top 5% of the population within your school. You know,
well,
at some point, it may be higher because they can afford classes. You're filtering out all the people that can't possibly afford classes.
I think there's a couple more filters than that. The more successful you become, the more successful the clientele is you attract, right? Number two is I do think, like in the kids market, we skew college-educated, enlightened, higher-level parents who are putting their child in. Plus, as you said, as you're going into a higher price point, you're automatically... And what people think is you're getting fewer students because you're charging more. The reality is you tend to be getting either better students or making the ones you're getting better, right? So I don't think it ever weeds, but what it does is it has a tendency to up the level of quality of what you're getting, right? You know, the other concept on this, to leave the subject, there was, I forget whose book it was, but there was some book with the EFC crowd 15 years ago or so we were all reading, and Steve LaValle was very into the concept. And basically it was make the list of the top 20 or top 50 people in your community that you'd like to have as a client. And then go specifically to work on those people, right? And over the years, I've done quite a few things of, you know, target the CEOs of the major banks for their kids, or target, you know, done, and a lot of that stuff you can do pretty low numbers because you're targeting, you know, a small strata. But you can actually, you know, you can go target the type of people you want. You can go target people with $500,000 a year income, $1 million a year income. You can go target CEOs. Sometimes it's harder to know that they're CEOs and they have, you know, kids, or they're, you know, not 82 and not able to do martial arts. Well, you know, whatever it might be. But you can go target those people directly. But the concept was, and Steve was really big on this for a while, is go target the top, and in Syracuse, I mean, it's a little different than Denver, but in Syracuse, he was very focused on, he grew up in a trailer park, and who were the people that he looked up to in the community who would have looked down on him, and that's not quite the way he thought about it, but you get the idea, that he would love to have his clients now, right, or his students. And he was very focused on, let's go target, you know, those people, those family, their kids, and try to get them into the school. And, you know, was very successful at that. I would look at it a slightly different way, especially if I'm in a big city like D.C. or Houston, is what groups of people would it be useful for me to target? Both from the standpoint of if they become raving fans, they might be able to do something useful for us, right? So would it be useful to target all the school principals at their home address to get them enrolled for their kids, not telling them that you're targeting that way? So now you have, you know, I mean, would it be useful to target all the PTO presidents if you get that list? would it be useful to target CEOs, you know, of banks or the CEO, you know, of maybe you want to target the owners of Sylvan Learning Centers in Kumon and Huntington and those guys to bring their kids in. And of course, you can target them directly to do joint ventures. But the more you can build that relationship, the better off you are, right? And again, you've got to take all these ideas from a standpoint of what's going to have enough bang for the buck to merit the attention. You know, Jan, in a community like yours, it certainly makes sense, both in what you already have, but in a fairly small community of going and getting all those community leaders, right? And it's probably a better way than what you were talking about, like be on the school board, right? Because that's going to be polarizing. And it's like he was talking about the politics, you know. Once you're in politics, you automatically have half that love you, half that hate you. Just, you know, depends on which half, right?
I have a list that I've been compiling since Black Belt Leadership. Right. Their first two qualifications is to get two letters of recommendation from teachers. Every single letter is at the very least a phone number if I need to contact them, usually a phone number and email address.
Right.
Just sending them something to thank them for.
You bet.
It's a really good start.
Absolutely. Well, or follow Joey to school and go meet the teacher.
Sure.
You know, go down and have lunch with him and meet his teachers there.
I just heard, and I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but I just heard that Hunsinger's Karate is a place you want to take your kids to solve problems that they're having issues with.
Right.
I'll take that every time.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Questions or thought on this? Is it making sense? Is it giving you some ideas? You know, I will tell you over the years, it's an extremely important component. And the martial art component for all of us allows you to make a lot of relationships that might otherwise not be available. But the client type of relationship we have, I mean, and keep in mind, I mean, their martial arts student or their child is a martial arts student is a lot different than their patron at McDonald's or their, you know, a patron at your dry cleaner store or something like that, right? I mean, we have a much different type of relationship with them. And assuming we're doing a great job for them, they really sincerely want to help, and especially once they see you're sincere about helping them, right? You got to have both of those elements. But anyway, let's shift topics here. What were some key elements that you guys picked up from Commissioner Carrick that would be translatable to what we do?
He basically said, inspect what you expect and
right.
Keep data regularly and check it out regularly.
Exactly. And by regularly, he meant daily.
Right. You're pretty much operating what you were speaking of on yeah. Daily rather than after the month is over.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, the conversation that I had with him to prep him, I really said to him, there's three or four things. Number one, even though this is a better group of school owners in the country, they really don't know what's going on inside their four walls in most cases, right? So it's, you know, everybody knows, like, how much money's coming in, how much money's going out. But we're in the consulting business, and we're shooting in the dark most of the time because we don't have very good data for what really to, like, target, right? So, you know, I mean, a lot of the calls, it ends up being, you know, play a guessing game of what's going on or 20 questions to try to figure out because you don't know what's going on. And if you have the numbers, there hasn't been much analysis of the numbers. So there's still holes, but it's a guessing game, right? So that was one of the, you know, points of conversation we had. The second point of conversation is, I said, we're here obviously focused on leadership. Part of that is leadership program and teaching leadership program. On the other side of it, the biggest problem that they have is having staff who are leaders that lead by example for the students. Because you can't have a leadership program for the students if you don't have the staff leading the charge and as a product of the product. And then we have to make sure the owners have enough personal accountability and enough ability to rise to the occasion, that all, you know, trickles down to the bottom, right? So that was the other second part of the conversation, is we're focused on leadership, but yet how do I imbue that in the students? But most importantly, I've got to get that in all the staff because they can be a product of the product to get that to happen. Does that make sense? And the thing that he said, which is I think in a short presentation, harder to translate is, you know, in his context, you got 54,000 people, and you got all kinds of people who want to be New York cops, and I fire that guy, and there's five in line behind him. That's like the Denver Broncos coach with Carl Mecklenburg, right? If the Broncos coach isn't sweating bullets over axing Mecklenburg if he needs to, because guess what? There's 882 people in line that want to be a pro football player, right, including the three other people on the bench. Does that sound like what our typical scenario is?
No.
What's our typical scenario? Oh, my God, if I lose this one.
Yes.
Right? And see, what you've got to realize is that's the problem, right? Is, and it's the rationale for having a solid leadership program and then a solid assistant instructor training program, It's the rationale with that, because the number one thing you've got to be developing constantly is bench strength. And woven throughout everything he said was several things. One was, know what's going on. Not because they told you it's going on, but because you have good numbers and you have eyeballs on to know if they told you the truth or not, right? I mean, remember the story of the guy's inspection is a mess and he's been told to clean it up. And now, right in the middle of the presentation, they're verifying that he's telling the truth, or in this case, lying, right? But it's what you said, inspect what you expect, that's the way you get respect. If you don't do that, then so many times you're getting BS from people, right? So they're giving you lip service on it. Same conversation you and I had recently, Carol. And so,
it's not that they're giving you BS, but if you don't keep the numbers straight and they don't know, you don't make that a priority for them to do, there's always some excuse. I mean, nobody likes to do that. It has to be a habit.
Right.
And so if they, it's not exactly, well, it is lying, but it's, we've got to be really strong at making sure that they know what they're supposed to be doing, and that's that every day they close out, every day they do the numbers, every day it's this way, and then we're all clear on what they all mean.
Right.
Then it's harder for them to, then if they're lying, it's a lie.
Yeah.
But if we don't make the first part right, then it's our fault. You know, that's what he said too. He said, you know, the first thing I've got to do is give you the tools to be successful. And then it's, if you don't use the tools, it's your fault.
Right.
Yeah, in our case, that's training them to make sure they know how to use it.
Right. Well, and so many times, we get stuck with somebody that there's just no way they're capable of rising to the occasion, right? Doesn't mean they can't be extremely successful in some other career, but they're never going to rise to the occasion in what we want to do, right? We end up with, like, an engineering personality, and you're trying to put them into a sales context. Yeah, I'm not talking about you. but where you end up with a narcissist, that you're trying to get them to be a teacher, right? And by the way, I see that in martial arts all the time. The highly gifted competitors chasing points, chasing trophies, have a tendency to bother watching themselves in the mirror much more than they worry about developing students, right? And that's the worst person you can ever have on the floor, okay? I don't care about their accomplishments as much as I care about the accomplishments of their students, right? And the person who cares more about the accomplishments of the students than they care about their own accomplishments are a good empathetic teacher. But again, you know, Travis, you've seen it all through the MMA thing. You know, they all want to hire, you know, this hot shit fighter. Well, they all suck as teachers. I mean, not all of them. There's the occasional good one. But most of them are horrible teachers, right? So what? The guy's won this title and done this, right? I mean, Jeff Smith's a hell of a good teacher. But there weren't many kickboxing champions who were, right? And same thing is with point karate, same thing with MMA, same thing is with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. You've got to not hire them for their physical talent. You've got to hire them on whether they're a good empathetic teacher, right? But is this making sense? So woven throughout everything he said was having numbers win daily on what's going on. And if you've read much about it, has anybody read much about the CompStat, all the police turnaround in New York City? See, the first thing he referenced, the that book and so forth, but they were operating on what was referred to as the broken windows theory, right? And the broken windows theory was, if you allow petty crime, is it seeps throughout the system, right? And the whole idea of broken windows is if somebody is going down the street and there's an abandoned warehouse with broken windows and graffiti, that all of the other crime numbers go up, right? There's a business book called Broken Windows for Business, I think, but it's the same thing. It's if you let small things go, piece of trash on the ground, the windows haven't been cleaned. If you let small things go, then larger things happen, right? So part of it was that broken windows theory, where they were before they perceived themselves to be so overwhelmed with things like murder and rape, that people jumping the turnstile, the idiots out there, you know, squeegeeing your windows when you're stuck at a stoplight looking for handouts. All that other stuff was being ignored, right? And it was one of the things that was controversial about Giuliani is, you know, one of his first things was get rid of those squeegee guys. Well, they were having a hard time figuring out how to get rid of the squeegee guys because they couldn't, like, keep them from walking on the thing, and technically they weren't doing anything illegal. And finally they figured out that an awful lot of them had outstanding warrants for other stuff. So they could either put them away on mental or they could put them away on warrants, and all of a sudden it just went away, right? So,
the tipping point, Mel references that.
Yes, absolutely. Is your way said?
No.
Tipping point.
And a tipping point, which was Malcolm Gladwell, he talked about that. Is it all comes together, then you get a tipping point where it just all fixes itself, right? But see, this is one of the things he talked about. And like before, for the New York City Police Department, is, like you said, they were waiting for end-of-the-year numbers to see whether they did a better job or didn't do a better job. And under Giuliani, they could drill it all the way down to the precinct level and then the street level of what was going on in real time. And so they could see there's an uptick in something or other happening, you know, from this block in this area, and go fix it right then and there before it spread. Does that make sense? And it's the same thing with everything we do. If you don't catch an uptick in people dropping out Wednesday rather than in 2 months, right? So, you know, that's why I'm always looking at the cards. Anybody who hasn't been in yet this week, if all of a sudden there's a bunch of them, I got a problem. By the end of the week, I really want to be on top. And I want to know what the numbers are so I know what's normative and what's an exception, right? So if I know what my normal one-weekend active is, I know what my normal two-weekend active is, and my normal three-weekend active is, and there's a spike, well, some of the spikes are going to be because it's 4th of July, and other spikes are going to be one of my instructors while I was on vacation did something really stupid, and now I got to go figure out how to do service recovery, right? I mean, anybody had that experience? Had that experience more than once, right? Is Tuesday night something happened, and didn't hear about what was happening. Well, usually I heard about what it was, but until you see the numbers spike, and now you got to go retrace and figure out what was going on, right? The second thing was he was talking about was same thing. Anybody read the West Point Way of Leadership, that book? What was the first thing they talked about? Yes, sir, no, sir, no excuses, sir, I don't understand, right? Is that's what he was talking about, right? And notice how clear he was. Give them all the resources they need, and if they can't accomplish it, they got to go. How many of us are that clear about our instructors and our program directors? You know, Nick O'Ganis' old line was hope springs eternal. See, that's what most of us do, right? Is we go, oh, well, he'll get it. No, he's a good guy. He'll get it. We'll just keep working on it. No. If you're going to have excellence, you've got to have that no excuses. And you've got to have the people who are capable of doing it, right? And, you know, and again, all of us, myself included, Master Moody, Jeff Smith, all of us have had the one that you just nurtured and, you know, and you'd see signs of brilliance and you'd hope that they were going to get it together. But you've got to really discipline yourself to know when it is time to cut the cord, right?
With the no excuses thing, I have a hard time between, like, I don't have any employees that are as motivated as I am in getting things done.
Nor will you ever.
Where do you draw the line? Yeah. Like, they do like half the things good, but they should do 70% good, 80%. Where is that before? Because sometimes it's frustrating because they're not doing what I would like them to do, but they are doing a lot. So
I would point out that, you know, he said that in an order. He said, I give them the stuff that they need and everything they need to know to do the job. And then if they can't do that, it was an order. You know, and I guess the first question I'd ask is, have we really given them enough stuff they know what to do? And, you know, I'm a believer in, you know, having stuff written down. I'm probably a little more that way than a lot of people. But, you know,
than anybody else on the face of the earth.
Maybe.
You're the top 1% AO retention.
Probably.
He used to always email me his latest revision of the operations manual after we had talked. And said, can you check pages 262 through 283 and see if that properly? I'm not exaggerating.
Yeah, no. Well, it's not actually that bad, though. At the end of the day, there's checklists the guys go through, and they got to do all the stuff. They got to send 5 grade work cards. They got to close out. They got to do their numbers. They got to put their stuff in the right place. You know, and I found if I didn't do something like that, at least it said, clean the school, here's the stuff you got to clean, then they would say, well, we didn't. Oh, we forgot that. Well, they can't kind of forget them. You know, so if I go to them and say, I wanted to avoid the situation where I'm talking to an employee about whether I explained it well enough. That's what we have to avoid is, that's the first thing is it really, you know, they say they didn't understand it, and you're like, come on, man, I told you 500 times. Well, okay, but if it's written down, they kind of like can't say that. It's here. Shut the hell up and do it next time. I mean, So I guess I'd ask that question first before you really address the second question, because that one you can control. That's the good news. If I didn't really explain it well enough, or I didn't have it written down, or I didn't, you know, if every other day I make them do the numbers, I don't make them do it daily, you know, we're fighting that all the time. He's right. Somebody I was talking to, not in the group here, that it's like he's got two schools, and if you have more than one school, you have to. You have no excuse not to have your numbers every day, no matter what. Oh, it's hard to get them to do it. Well, it's you. It's the guy. It's not the employee at that point.
Well, so I guess I told this story once, but it was that when I was a NASCAR promoter, and I was ending up going to like 10 or 12 tournaments a year. But all of the other guys had the standing joke. Hey, Oliver, it's 5:45. Where are your stats? Right here. Right? But it was, you know, the final show were usually on Saturday night. And I was always showing up the final show with my stats. Because the deal was they had to be done in my office at 3:00 on Saturday. And then they were getting faxed to me wherever I was. And if they weren't on the fax machine by 4 Mountain, which was usually like 6, which was 6 Eastern, is there was hell to pay. And it usually was, I'm at the final show, and I'm either judging or going through the stats to prep for the Monday meeting. And all of the promoters and all the top people all had the same running joke. Yeah, there's all of the stats over there. Are you ever going to work any tonight? I'm working. No, I mean, like, you're here at a tournament, right? Tell me when you need me. I'll be there. But it's got to be that regular. If you don't have it. So I guess, continue on with your question, which is, you know, it's trying to bring an abstraction into concrete, right? You know, if you have the three things, do they have the capability, right? I mean, the aptitude, and are they motivated enough to do their job, and have they been trained adequately to do it? And that includes knowing specifically what it is that they need to do, right? And my argument is, you can't do anything about their aptitude. My argument is their motivation is their problem, not my problem, except that we all have a tendency to put a bunch of Mickey Mouse stuff in their way to hurt their motivation, right? So, you know, if you try to motivate everybody by having a pep rally every day, right, and get them on the phone and pump them up and they're depressed, and that doesn't work, right? But you've got to keep all the demotivating stuff out of their way. And part of that is clear communication. if they thought they were getting an extra $300 this week and they get an extra $290 for $10, you just piss them off, right? So you've got to be careful about all those kinds of things. But if they've been adequately trained and that includes knowing what to do, then you've got to set the minimal accepted standard. Zig Ziglar wrote a book called, I think, Top Performance. Does that sound right? And in it, he walks through exactly what you're asking, which is, his example was like a real estate sales office, where you tell them, in order for you to have a desk in this office, here's your minimum level of performance, etc. Right? And then your target level of performance is here, and if you hit this, you know, angels sing and rainbows, you know, will appear and so forth, right? So here is super good, here is our target, and below here you don't have a desk, right? But the more you can define your expectations of that, right, is this is the minimum acceptable performance in order for you to have a job. But here's really what we're shooting for, and ultimately our high goal is this. If you can put it into that kind of parameter, it works really well. And sometimes you can, sometimes you can't, right? In macro numbers, it's usually fairly easy. Here's how many enrollments we need, here's how many intros we need, here's what gross we need, here's what retention level we need. On a smaller level, there's all of those nitpick stuff that can be a real irritant of you're supposed to be here at 4, and you know, you got here at 4:10, 4:20, you know, right? So there's that type of stuff. You're supposed to be wearing this uniform and you're out of the uniform, there's all that kind of stuff. And my argument is on all that kind of stuff is that's the minimum acceptable, right? And if you have any tolerance at all, then that becomes the broken window thing, right? So if the guy shows up and he's out of uniform, if send him home to get, you know, a uniform. You know, my standard thing was, you know, we'd have the staff meeting, and we had the drink policy and the lunch policy. And so if you're a branch manager and you're late, you bought everybody lunch. And if you were staff otherwise and you were late, you bought everybody drinks. And if you no-showed, in order to keep buying everybody drinks, we just bought everybody lunch on your behalf and took another check, right?
This might tie in with what Master was just saying there, but what do you do with a situation where you might have a goal of somebody in enrollment, but in order to get the enrollment, you have to get the appointments. In order to get the appointments,
right,
you have to have the leads.
Right.
And the leads are not coming in because you share, in my situation, I share a responsibility for generating the leads.
Right.
So now I can't really hold anybody accountable for anything.
You mean other than yourself?
Yeah,
right.
Myself, right.
Wait a minute, you
say that again?
Yeah, we've got the
accountable for anything.
I may have been optimistic about being able to pull out here until 8.
Yeah, it looks like a bathroom break might be over.
Yeah. No, I mean the
bathroom break. Oh,
the
noise.
Loud.
Yeah. The noise is a little loud, but you, because you know, if you go to too fine of detail in the numbers that you're holding people accountable to, and the bonus system is super complicated, just like we said for sales yesterday, if it's too complicated, it won't respond, it won't work.
Yeah.
So you've got to, that's a tough one, because we like to reward people for a whole bunch of different tasks, but you know, you really can't. That minimum level.
Then it's kind of like you're rewarding them for nothing.
Yeah, exactly. Because they don't understand it. If they don't, you know, if they don't get why they're hitting that. And the other part of that is making sure that they know it on a regular daily basis, back to the daily point, is if they don't know it on a regular basis where they're at and what that's going to mean by the end of the month, then they really can't take action. And that's what Bernie was saying.
Well, and let me answer the question from two different ways. First off, you've got to start at the point where they can be held 100% accountable. Right? And then you've got to give them a benchmark for that. We got the toilet will close and the wedding party is
open. $5 to come back in.
At least that
instrument is going to get.
I'm sorry.
No, you're fine.
Oh, you gotta lock it though now.
Oh, no. You know, I got to tell you the funny story was, you know, the Dan Kennedy thing, right, is the guy has a bladder like three camels or something, right? Is I swear you could do 3 days straight and he never went to you, right? But it wasn't only that. It was as you're getting up, you'd hear, Oliver, a weak bladder costs you money. It's like, you know, you're like, what do you want me to do? Bring a bottle and piss on this isn't a site. But so I have great empathy for but to answer your question, you've got to start at a point where you can hold them 100% accountable. Right? So you can't have it be they're pointing the finger that it's you.
Yeah.
And let me give you an a real life example that I had quite a few years ago. I had two different people over the years whose full-time job was exclusively and only, and occasionally we had to do a few other things, but was mostly exclusively and only, go work with elementary schools and set up programs for us in the elementary schools to hand off to the schools, right? So, you know, across, let's say, five locations, Larry Arado and then Chris Perry, right, is, and Larry had been a salesman for one of the big publishing companies, so when they go in and they set up, you know, like book fairs and so forth, and they meet with the parents and try to sell them, you know, maybe an encyclopedia, but something. But that's what he had done already, so he already had some of that skill set. But where I would have problems with that was the point at which there was a handoff, right? So if I had Larry go deal with whatever it was, you know, XYZ elementary school, and he's going to go set up gym teacher for the day or an after school program or what it was, I always had to be careful at how much of the process he was responsible for versus at what point he handed it off to the school, right? Because if he went and made the contact, set it up tentatively, called the school and had them go in, the school almost always blamed him for being crappy at setting it up and, you know, and exaggerating what he got done. Because half the guys would go in and they wouldn't get anything done, but they blame Larry. And of course, half of them had never even shown the hell up to begin with, right? But it was always Larry's fault, right? And you could track that all the way through. And ultimately, my conclusion was, when I had somebody in a marketing role like that, I always liked to get it where they handled them all the way through signing the student up at the school and then handed it off to the school. And we're compensated for that chain, because at the point of handoff, I would always get fingers being pointed both ways, right? And a lot of times it was across multiple schools. There would be the one or two guys that were really happy about him working together and would do just fine, and the three that were always talking to him about what the deal was. And really it was they were dropping the ball, but now they had a good excuse, right?
Plus, the further down the train you track, the easier it is, because you got less, you know, you're looking on based on results, not based on,
yeah,
how many schools did you visit, how many kids did you talk to, how many this did you do, how many these did you get from Holy Box. Then it's very hard, it's complicated to track all that.
Yeah. And I'll give you another example. This was Jenry Institute 33 years ago. You'd have the meetings, but they had it set up that there was a few, you know, a number of faults in the system, although they were doing big numbers. But the biggest fault I identified, having been one, right, is every school had a full-time head instructor and a full-time program director who were, on paper at least, of complete equal status and getting paid the same amount, both getting paid a percentage, and had equal responsibility for the school. Sounds good on paper. In practical terms, anything that went wrong, oh, you always got this, right? That's why I went to, I've got a branch manager and I got everybody else. And it's always her fault, or it's his fault, or if they're having good results, you know, right? And that way, what happens is you can't say, you can't have him say, well, it's my instructor's fault. You know, Simon, I got to tell you, the deal is train, hire the right person, supervise them well, right? And if it's the right wrong guy, let's get rid of him and get somebody else, right? Are you ready to fire him? No. Okay. Well, does he have some training gaps? Well, yeah, he really doesn't know what he's doing. Well, okay, what are you doing about that? Right? And so all of a sudden now there wasn't this, right? Works a lot better. And it goes back again, responsive to your question. You've got to have the chain at the point where they can't go like that and have any credibility.
And that simplifies everything.
Yeah. Just simplifies everything. The other thing is just having a no excuses environment, right?
Yeah.
Is so many of us want to be nice rather than being direct. And, you know, and Commissioner Carrick said it, you know, you don't want to verbally berate people or anything else, but the more numbers you have, the more black and white it is, right? And I've had a lot of, you know, high-level executives work for me over the years who didn't like that system. They didn't want to have everybody's numbers up, and they didn't want to have, you know, the ones who are doing well next to the ones who are doing poorly because they felt that, like, embarrassed people. Well, I'm not trying to embarrass anybody. It's like, you know, it's like going bowling, and you look up at the scorecard, right? Is you just have to have the scorecard. And we're always looking at the scorecard publicly. And the ones who are doing poorly to a great extent, their numbers will start getting better just because they'll go, well, I'm smarter than that yo-yo, and he's doing double the number I am. You know, that's embarrassing, right? You know, they mostly won't say it out loud, but in their mind, you know, that's what they're thinking, right? So if you have all the numbers there, it just forces a lot of them to come up to at least what the norm or the higher levels, right? And across multiple schools, that's why you always want to have, like, the lead dog. The only, like in your guys' case, the only problem with that would be is you've got to get it to be one of the other branches. Because now they're going to say, well, that location is always going to be doing big numbers, right? So you've got to get one of the others doing big numbers to get everybody else.
Well, plus it's you guys there.
Yeah.
Yeah, if the lead dog can't be you, because then it's because it's you.
Yeah.
It's almost an artifact that you'll end up getting the next one down won't be as good. It's hard to make them compete with you.
Right.
That's why when I got to four schools, I didn't teach anymore on purpose.
Yeah.
Like, you know, people were, aren't you teaching, you know? No, because if I do that, I'm handicapping what the other guys do. And inevitably, the school I was at continued to do well, but it brought the other guys up. But if it's me teaching there, or the worst yet is if I'm teaching at all four schools a different day, that's just like a mess.
Yeah, that doesn't work.
And,
yeah, you might be worse off than not having, you know, sat at home and call it in. The only caveat I would give to that, I had a lot of success over the years, if necessary, being the turnaround guy.
Going into one school for a period of time.
Right.
But not every school spread.
Right.
But then go in and then, yeah.
But what I would always do is go into the worst one, right? So I would always go whatever was the worst one and go turn it around, right? But I'd take the worst one to the best one, you know, to make it the best one. But you're never going to have all of them doing the numbers you're doing, but they'll keep pace, right? And what it did is it eliminated excuses, or at least most of them. Because then the excuse was, well, nobody's you. You know, they can't, you know, I can't, you know, do what you do. So you're always better off if you've got a staff guy who is able to do that, or if you can subtly or not so subtly get them to do that. But at the worst case scenario, if you go into the worst location and push it way up, right? And in your case, it may just be, you know, across multi-programs, getting one of the programs going so strong that it pulls the others up with it. Does that make sense? Rather than, you're better off doing that than trying to push everything up evenly. Because that's, you know, fool there. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Other thoughts or ideas that you picked up from Commissioner Carrick?
On the crisis management,
yeah.
You brought up points about being proactive and doing the mock things. So, as a follow-up to go back to the schools, kind of just think of the all the different crises that could happen all across the world as well.
So, oh, yeah.
Whether it's the students or the parents. Or
you bet.
So how would we deal with it as the staff or crisis with the staff? How would we deal with it as business owners?
Well, that's a good, it'd be a real good exercise, because what are all of the crises that could happen that could be significant to your school, right? So if you think about that for a second, I mean, what are some of them? What's that?
Injury.
Yeah.
Lost stuff, yeah.
Eight-year-old boy accuses instructor of trying to sexually molest him. It hits the newspaper.
That'd be a nightmare.
Yeah. I've had things like that three or four times over the years. Right? One of them was your brother. Right? So, you know, knowing how to deal with that. What's that?
No, just clarify.
Clarify.
My brother.
Your brother-in-law wasn't the culprit. He was the victim.
No. He was the culprit.
He was the culprit.
No. Okay. No.
He wasn't my brother-in-law, so clarify that one. Well, I never knew the guy.
What was his relationship to you? He had some relationship.
Sister's boyfriend.
Okay. Or his sister's boyfriend. Who we
and I got him a job.
Yeah. So it's forever your
job.
Yeah. Well, though, in this case, it was, what was he, 23 or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, 23 to 25. And we found him out in back of the school during a sleepover with a 13-year-old who had her clothes off. After he had taken her to the liquor store.
Oh!
I'm not exaggerating.
No, you can't make
what's that?
Not a grave, is it?
It was really close.
I'm sure.
It was really close. It was personally the closest I've ever come to completely decking somebody. And but you know, it was, you know, I've done all the NLP stuff and all the Tony Robbins. I was doing all that. You were there. Weren't you? I don't remember. But I was doing all the NLP stuff, right? So I still wore glasses, so I took my glasses off so I wouldn't be like focused on him. And I was focusing on the fact there's like 42 kids looking through the plate glass windows behind me. So when I take him out, they're going to have all Watchmaster Oliver Kell, their instructor. I had no idea what was going on otherwise. So he actually showed up. When I showed up to meet him, he had his shirt tail hanging out and his zipper was unzipped and he was kind of disheveled. I mean, this is at 3 a.m., right? It basically just ended with, you know, I'm not sure I know all the details of what's going on, but you're suspended, and you're lucky to be alive right now. We'll talk again in a few days and figure out if we can sort it all out. The worst part was telling the mom what happened the night before. Of several incidents like that, we've never had it hit the newspaper, but it was, in my estimation, it was always one, having enough goodwill in the community because we were doing so many things, people gave us the benefit of the doubt. And two, it was aggressively dealing with it proactively. And three, it was having such an unshakable clarity about how all that stuff was off limits that it never mushroomed. You know, when I looked at what happened with LaValle, my first reaction was, God, I'm surprised they didn't have a huge sexual scandal 10 years ago, 12 years ago, 15 years ago. I had told people that before. It's like, everything is so out of control. I'm surprised that it took this long, right? Now, what it was surprised me, but it didn't surprise me that sooner or later it blew up, right? And in fact, like 15 years before, they had two different statutory rape things hit the newspapers, both of them with staff. And the articles were always, you know, instructor at LaValle Sport Karate accused of, right? And that was the headline. But yeah, I mean, think of what kind of crises can happen. You can certainly have the crisis of something happens in your shopping center and you're closed down for a while. How would you deal with that? We've had that before. You know, all of a sudden power is
you
out.
Go off. Yes.
Yeah.
I'd rather something a little more normal, like parents pissed off. Okay.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't there.
I wouldn't call that a crisis. That's kind of normal operation.
Yeah.
But you know, like, what would you do if it shut down? We had that happen once. We taught outside and until we, or it was a sewer issue.
Yeah.
So the school was horrible inside.
Oh, I had one of those.
Yeah. That's disgusting.
I had my lights go out on Halloween once. I taught for Halloween. I did some candles. I said.
Yeah, we pulled up all the parents' cars and shined it through the plate glass window. As usual. But the sewer one's the worst. I had that one twice at the old Lakewood school. And it was, the problem with this school was it was a breaker box in the back with no back door. And so you had to walk into the school and go through the school in the dark to get to the breaker box to turn the lights on.
Sorry, I was trying to use the weak ladders, cost money going on.
Yeah.
Nobody's listening.
Yeah. But I got about halfway to the back and was up to here in what turned out to be raw sewage. Yeah, it's just, you know, just disgusting. And
time to break for dinner.
Exactly. On that note. But it is a good one. I mean, go through all the different things that could happen. I mean, long before cell phones, you know, we had grand openings where we went in and opened the school and everything was going great except the phone company couldn't put our line in for 5 months. And we were having to use the pay phone now front. I mean, seriously, we had info calls coming in to the other. Well, the info calls we had going into a different number. We had to use pay phone on the front.
See, if the phone doesn't work, that's a crisis to me.
Yeah.
Certain things like that. If the phone doesn't work, it's a crisis. And that happened to me once and the guys didn't know it. Luckily, I called for something else. And usually I call on the back line.
Right.
The student, what we call the student line. I don't call on the main line. For some reason, I called on that. It didn't work. And I'm like, you know, going ballistic because that can't happen ever.
Jeff Smith had that a couple weeks ago.
Did he?
When we were at Sturgis, all of a sudden the phone company had done something crazy and the main line into the school had gone crazy.
Well, but your guys can do something like that. Like leave the phone off the hook or do something or unplug it or do something stupid. It can happen. So that's something to regularly check. The other thing that...
Well, you know, as a complete tangent on that, that's why I've been recommending anybody who asks, anyway, using something like Ring Central. Because nowadays, you can port the main number into an internet-based system. We use Ring Central. And so you can port it into Ring Central. And then if there's a problem, let's say with the landlines at the school, because that's typically what happens, is some construction guy cut a line or something happened, then you can reroute it to your cell phone. You can reroute it to a different number.
Also makes it easier to reroute it for normal processes.
Yeah. Well, you can have a pre-program. So you can have it where the phone rings this cell number from 9 a.m. to noon, then it rings this cell number from noon to 3, and then it rings the landline of the school and another mobile number in the evening. And then if there's some glitch somewhere, you can just go in and reset it easily. So, you know, those things are cheap nowadays, right? So, one, you can probably save some money on how many landlines you need.
Yeah, I like the idea that he said, though. I was going to mention, not to get off on the crisis, right? And I don't do this. I'm going to start doing it where you talk through some scenarios. You don't have to spend a lot of time. Like, sounds like that was their job, so they had to do it all the time. But, you know, like some of these, well, what would it happen if the lights went out? What would you do? And just so the
Well, they're dealing with a little bit bigger shit than we're doing. Right. They're in gas attack on the subway.
I mean, that's their job that, you know, they have to pay attention to that stuff a lot more. But, you know, even if they thought about three or four scenarios, like what would happen if the lights went out, what would you do? Well, we teach outside. If they go through that mentally a few times, about once every quarter, whatever, then if it happens, then they won't just close the school. Somebody recently, were you on the phone with them? That they came back and the school was closed. Maybe you weren't on the phone with this guy. They said their guys closed the school. They were gone out of town. Right.
Was that Chester? Was it that Chester?
Might have been on a call. It was something like that, that the school was closed for like a day or two. Like, the hell?
I mean, I'd have had to jump in there.
I'd be in the park, you know, or whatever. I mean, I guess if you're in Wisconsin in the winter and it's 13 degrees outside, I might not do that. But there's got to be something, you know, or call a church that is nearby and move them there. It can be an opportunity to market when you're at that place. I mean, there's lots of...
We've had it a bunch of times where it's... That space is supposed to be ready on January 1st, and we're vacating this space on January 1st, and that space is ready in March, right?
Right.
And you know, and that's a pretty easy solve if you've thought about it ahead of time, you know, and you and I both expect that scenario.
Yeah, if you plan for that scenario to happen, then you're crazy.
Because it almost always does.
Yeah.
And like if you're moving from one space to the other, I always plan for a 3 or 4 month overlap, right? So whatever day they told me this one's going to be done, I plan to be there for another 2 or 3 months. And when it's a startup, always plan for what's the alternatives.
Yeah, one time I negotiated that in the contract.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to be this many months. So I, if the one delayed, I didn't have to pay rent
on
the other way. But anyway,
right.
But that's a side thing. But yeah, what would happen? Crisis, like, scenario planning a little bit would probably be a bad idea.
Well, with that, you just don't want the free rent to start until they've pulled the CO.
Right.
Right, so that if they're responsible for construction, it's the day they hold the CO that the free rent period starts.
Right.
I just got a pissing match with one of our landlords because he had given me a year free rent, and then he gave us the space 2 weeks late. And so I was arguing we should get, you know, two additional months. I lost that one, by the way. It wasn't worth getting to a pissing match after he'd already given us a free year, right? I was proud of that negotiation. But where were we at? So we're on the crisis thing. What were some of the other lessons from what he was talking about? Did you catch a couple things? One is the budget for the city of New York is bigger than what? 42 states?
40 states.
How many?
40 states.
40 states. 40 out of 50 states?
Yes.
And the New York City Police Department, the number I remember, was it's bigger than something like all but 5 standing armies in the world, right? Because they have what do you say 54? Is it 54,000 uniformed?
Yes.
I think it may be 54,000 staff and something like 40,000 are uniformed officers or something like that. But it's a bunch, right? All you have to do is go to Times Square. I mean, I swear there's more cops in Times Square than the entire Denver Police Department. And they need it. I mean, it's that kind of density.
I like Terry. He also talked about the PV level, but, you know, all employees are treated equally, not from the sense of treating them with respect, but just to hold them as accountable. Because right now, I've got some assistant instructors who pay $50 a week or something, and I have never really sat down and conveyed the expectations with them. You're affecting this, and this, so give them some metrics to also go off.
You know, a different way to look at exactly what you're saying is the number one tenet you're teaching as you're developing them through leadership and through assistant teaching is you're teaching them personal accountability. And then if you start treating them like staff at a less accountable level, you're taking away the lessons from them, right? And it's the reason why it really is so important to have leadership, assistant teaching, to have that track going on. Number one, you're developing bench strength. But number two, really, you're taking the top third of your school and having them all exhibit the levels of leadership and have them all exhibit the level of personal responsibility that you want the staff to do, right? And where I see a lot of people make a mistake is they implement this really well. And then they have the staff member that, you know, my worst nightmares were you have the 18-year-old female instructor who comes in and bare midriff, halter top, and everything else, and then goes and changes real quick and sets a bad example. Or you have the guy who comes in with a, you know, beer T-shirt, or, you know, he hasn't shaved that day. For us, it was always, they came into a staff meeting and they forgot to shave. I'm sitting in the back with a razor and they're shaving, right? And if they came in and they're not in the right uniform, I'm sending them home. And so you've got to be completely aware, right? I mean, I'm not exaggerating. I mean, it's got to be all those little details. And so, and you've got, so like on that, you've got to have the uniform for what they wear into the school and then the uniform they have when they're teaching. And I see a lot of you don't do that, right? So, you know, with ours, it was the blue polo shirt, black slacks, black dress shoes, right? So I didn't want them wearing in, like, you know, orange running shoes, and didn't want them to be in jeans. We had a no jeans policy, period, in the sentence, right? So if they came in and they weren't, like, in that uniform, they had to go get in that uniform. And, you know, and the excuse would be, well, I'm going to go immediately in the back room and change. No, You know, you're walking into the business and you're an employee or staff member of the business. I remember a movie theater booth, and this was like 12-year-old. Came in, and there's a 12-year-old, like, new black belt helping, and he's got a green mohawk. And, like, all the staff thought it was really cool, and they're having an administrative, and I'm like, you know, go fix your hair, right? Well, and then, but the staff guys are like, we can't tell. I mean, you can't, you know. You're going to be in a leadership role, you got to look the part. And then they'll say, well, all the other 12-year-olds think he's really cool. I said, yeah, but none of the moms want a 12-year-old to look like him, right? So go fix it, right? And you've got to know what your standards are in your school, but you've got to not let any of them deviate from it.
And I think you've got to be consistently, the easiest way to make that easy
is be consistent.
Super consistent about it. And if they ever make a little tiny mistake, don't let it go and tell them. And the challenge with that, I found, is not so much me doing that, because I'm really crazy about that if anything's out of place. But it's the staff members. Well, I realized that I wasn't training the managers to be that way. And so the managers would let it slide a little bit. And all the instructors were trained by me. So when I kind of made the transition of not being there all the time, the instructors were trained by me, so they were all really good, and they would all follow the rules, and everything would happen. But the managers that were above them, who were also really good and followed the rules, but they didn't know they had to be really picky all the time. But the easiest way to make that happen is just be super picky all the time. And a lot of these things, in a week or two, like the dress code thing,
oh,
if you tell everybody, yeah, in a week or two, it's done. It never will happen again. But then if somebody shows up at the wrong whatever, then, like, I never show up. I didn't even own a pair of jeans until I had, like, I think six schools. Like, I mean, I owned them before, but, like, I never wore them because I never had any occasion where I
wanted to. Well, and I remember, like, your dress code was, what, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, they wear the red polo
shirt.
Yeah,
I had that for a while. Right. And all the staff had to wear exactly the same polo shirts. And
right.
Then we went to one. It was easier.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
We just always had the one, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know.
I did it that way, then they, I kind of hope they washed the shirts. If they wore the same.
No, we're not talking about one shirt.
No, I know.
One combination.
I gave him three shirts. So Monday was white, Tuesday was red, and Thursday, whatever. It was white, red, black, or right.
Just hire people that have a washing machine.
I know.
But, you know.
They wash their clothes if they're going out Friday night.
Yeah, exactly. The other thing on that same topic is you've got to learn to be hyper aware of everything going on, right? I mean, my staff always had the running gag that nothing happened that I didn't know about, and they would joke about there was video cameras in all the schools and they were all wired down, even though none of them were. Okay, nowadays I would have every inch wired, right? I mean, it's what, $500 to plug it into the internet. But then it wasn't. But it was. I never missed noticing anything, right? So if this instructor was dating one of the students, I was always the first to catch it, and they could never figure out how I caught it. But it was just I paid attention to everything going on. But it's like walking into the classroom. If there's 50 people lined up and those five have their belt tied backwards, you got to notice it, right? So I'll always be the one of why are their knots wrong? Why do we have three women with earrings in? Like, what the hell is going on with that? And she's got a ring on. And, right? I mean, it'll be. And if you don't do that every time, then all of a sudden all the standards fall. Right? You got to decide what your standards are, but you can never not notice, because then they don't notice. That makes sense? And that comes back a little bit to your conversation, Jeff, is they're never going to care as much as you do. But if you never let those little things go away, you know, it's easier to just get it right than to hear you bitching it all the time, right?
And again, I can't imagine 100% of the time, no matter what, our pads are a certain way, the uniform is a certain way, the thing's a certain way. And if you let that slide, it's a million times more work.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're super consistent all the time, it's actually pretty easy. But it's when you let it slide 1% of the time, that now it's constant.
Yeah.
So if you find yourself constantly reminding them to do stuff, the most likely thing I've found is that I'm not being consistent enough and making them do it all the time.
Yeah.
And then I don't hardly have to remind them at all.
Well, I remember.
It's kind of a backwards logic, right? But it's the way it works.
Any of you guys remember Jay Kim's Brother? Mm-hmm.
Yes. D.C., Virginia?
Yeah, Baltimore. Baltimore. But he was trying to recruit me and Ernie Reyes, senior, at one time. And so we flew to Baltimore, and we did the tour of the office and all this stuff. And he had a bunch of guys from Bally's, Holiday Health and Fitness. They were helping him run it. And he grew to like 50 locations. But we walked into a school, and he walked us in the office and said, look here, right? So we looked in the drawer, and there's a couple pens and whatever. I forget exactly what it was. And he says, I said, well, what's special about that? He goes, well, never mind, let's go to the next location. Went to the next location, he pulls up the drawer, and it's exactly the same. And his point was, of all the 50 locations, they had the spec of what needed to be in the top left-hand drawer, what needed to be in the middle drawer, what right, I mean, it was all identical. Now, that sounds anal retentive, but if you're in the middle of a sale, and you can't find the pen to get the agreement filled out, is it a problem, right? Or if they don't have a membership contract, and you're now digging around, right? I remember going into my own schools, and I would go do a conference for them, and then it's like, what? Where are the agreements? And so the guy's digging through the desk drawer to find, are you kidding me? You know, they're giving me money, and you can't find the damn agreement with it. You know, what the hell? So all those things are important components. Does that make sense?
And we actually have the file folder in the intro room has tabs on it, and there's a printed sheet that they print out, and they stick the tabs in. They're always in exactly the same order. So they know when they're looking, and they're color-coded, so they know what they're looking for. Well, and that way, when I train them, I can train them in one location, but they can be in any location and still work.
We have three folders already made up with everything you need inside the folder.
That's really
and
new, too.
I pull a folder out of everything you need for the sale is there.
Yeah, if you want to have multiple schools, I would even expand that further. Like the supplies that go in there are in a specific, they're placed in a certain way so that nobody has to go searching.
Well, given my particular personality type, it has to be on one of those little clear pocket folders on the wall so I can see it. Because if it's in a drawer, it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So mine was always, I can, you know, in the intro room, I can see the three pieces of paper I need and the thing, and it was never in a drawer. And the first thing I would do is empty all the drawers and figure out where it needed to be so I could see it at all times, right?
It's yours.
Not mine.
Yeah.
There you go.
The models.
Yeah, you say it's time to wake up. It's 7:10 a.m.
It was being exactly that.
Anybody ever done that before?
Yes, sir.
The only time I ever do that is when I have an early flight out of somewhere. I was staying at Jeff Smith's townhouse one time, and I had a flight. Oh, and this is a good one. It was when we did the event in San Diego, and so June Ree had a big like 50th anniversary thing that was on Thursday, and the event in San Diego was on Friday. And so I booked it where I went Denver, Washington, D.C., did June Ree's thing, Washington, D.C., San Diego, did our thing, and had like an extra hour or so. And I was staying at Jeff Smith's townhouse and woke up at 10 after 7 and had a 7:42 flight. And made the flight. Believe it or not, made the flight. It was literally, you know, and it was Jeff that said, you have a flight, right? Shouldn't you be up? Yeah, my alarm said, what time is it? Why does that sound bad? Oh. but he lives like right next to Dulles, right? So it's, you know, it's 5 minutes to Dulles. And luckily, Dulles, strangely, never has a security alarm. I have never.
That's because they've got that really weird setup where it's super long.
Yeah, there's 22.
Did you know when they have the cart things?
Oh yeah, I always hated that. That wasn't then.
Oh.
But when that fact, that's how I made my flight. Is it was one of the few flights that leave from the main terminal rather than having to go to the other terminal. So it was go for security and then right down whatever.
Yeah, that's
like Z gauge or something. But
that should be on our list to go to DCO. We went to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think if people haven't gone to D.C., that would be a good location, because that's...
There were a lot of opportunities doing the D.C. When we went, we stayed right out by Dulles and went over to the Sterling School, which was extremely productive. But there are certainly a lot of other interesting things to do, New York City and D.C. But anyway, what are some other lessons and other thoughts that came up from his conversation?
Don't be afraid to use fear.
Yeah.
And praise too, God.
Right.
You know, which it's what I needed to go
about. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, ultimately that comes down to there's only one person in church, right? It's not a democracy. You know, my favorite line on that was Gene Hackman in, what was that submarine movie? Remember the one?
Thunder?
No.
Thunder.
It wasn't that one. It was the other one.
Yeah, it was
Denzel Washington.
Denzel Washington, yeah. But the submarine movie.
Red
October. Red October was coming. This is different. But anyway, it was Crimson Tide. But at the beginning of Crimson Tide, they have the entire submarine crew lined up, and he's got his umbrella and his poodle, and he says, "Men, we are here to protect democracy, not to practice it." But the same thing he said, right, is, you know, ultimately you've got to be in charge, and you want everybody's opinion, you want everybody's input, but then when you get marching orders, we've got to all be marching in the same line. And a lot of us are just afraid to say, you know, that, and you don't want to do it in an egotistic way, but ultimately it's got to be, you know, and I've had a few where we were having little staff arguments, and I had to say, look, last time I checked, I'm in charge, right? So, good idea, but we're going to do this, and, you know, let's go for it. And you always got to be aware of not only active resistance, but passive resistance. Yeah, because a lot of times it'll be, we're going to go do this, then they just go do whatever they were doing anyway. You've got to be able to catch that. That's what you get a lot, right? Is you just get passive resistance, which... Anyway, any other thoughts or lessons from his conversation? There are a couple people that...
I thought with the accountability, starting at the top, makes it, you're accountable to make sure that other people are accountable, not
right.
To assume it, and that everybody knows it's very clear.
Yeah.
Well, if you come in the wrong dress code, then
yeah,
they're not going
right. to... Yeah. Well, you got to have the moral authority, right? Like my meeting drink policy. That would never have worked if I fairly regularly showed up late, right? And, you know, and my example of that was the one time I remember showing up late was at an intramural tournament. So it was, you know, I bought pizza for everybody who was staff, quasi-staff, sort of staff. I was on the phone to Domino's and ordered like 42 pizzas, right? But if I hadn't done that, right? And when you're in a leadership role or management role, you can get away with it a lot of times because they don't know what you're supposed to do, right? And so I could have strolled in at 11 and said, this is when I expected to be here. But it was much better from a staffing wise to spend the $150 on pizzas to make a point, right? And that was my logic, is I was much better off to fess up and say, oh my God, you know, I'm an hour and a half late and here's $200 of pizza I just bought.
And that has to do with integrity, too, that they know that that's the case. Because I'm sure there's lots of times where you expect them to start on time and do stuff and be there without you there.
Right.
You know, maybe you're picking up the guest at the airport, maybe something's happening.
Exactly.
You don't have to report that to them.
No.
So don't establish that you've got to follow their rules necessarily. You just got to follow the rules. The rules
right.
are this. We're supposed to be on time. You're supposed to wear the right stuff. You follow those rules. And that might not be, you know, like I'm having an inter-school tournament, I show up when the black belts start, you know, can be out, but the other guy's got to show up when everybody's starting. But we try to do that on purpose to make it a big deal when I show up.
Yeah.
You know, we're strategic about it. But
sure.
My point is that it doesn't have to be their rules. But you have to have integrity about it. You did.
Right.
You're like, you realized I was late, so you did it because you knew that was
exactly. You know, and it would have been a lost opportunity if I didn't.
So if you finish late, tonight, then you gotta buy dinner for everybody?
Is that it?
I don't know. I just thought maybe that
okay.
The integrity thing sounds might. Yeah. It's not the rule. It's not the rule, but everybody might, you know.
Are you talking Stromboli or are you talking New York?
I don't know. Yeah, the Stromboli.
Stromboli, maybe. That was pretty good. You know, if mine was a 2-for-1, I think, so.
We could share. You know, we could split her.
Depends on how cheap we think you are. other thoughts or lessons from what he was talking about?
I like the story told where he walked up the bridge, and, you know, kind of relate that to, like, he wouldn't ask anyone to do anything he's not willing to do.
Right.
Yeah, that was a great story. That was a good example.
You know, there's a great book. And in full disclosure, the guy is crazy and he's a bit foul-mouthed. Not a bit, very. But it's by Dick Marchenko. Anybody read any of Dick Marchenko's books?
Who left Marchenko? Right?
Oh, that's right. I heard that was a really bad cultural fit.
It was interesting.
Yeah. But he wrote a book called The Rogue Warrior on Leadership. And it's out of print. I think you can get it in Kindle or one thing or another. But it's really good. And one of his main premises is always lead from the front, right? Which is exactly the same thing. And in his case, he was the guy that ran the first SEAL team group that was anti-terrorism. And they were tasked with go break into every naval installation in the country to see if they could, or in the world, to see if they could, to see how well the nuclear subs and the nuclear weapons were protected. And he did it so well, he pissed off all the hierarchy because they broke into every base in international, you know, with swim in and put fake bombs in the subs and one thing or another. But that book is a really good book. The Rogue Warrior on Leadership. Oh, there you go. There you go. And he's got a whole series of books. The first one is autobiographical, which is really good. And then they go into fiction. And it's kind of like the later into the series you get, the less believable and more kind of outrageous they are. But the first autobiography is really good. And then that book is really good. Some other thoughts from Commissioner Carey?
Have to balance the accountability with the recognition.
Yeah.
Not just the accountability. When didn't get done, but right. Did get done. Highlight people in that capacity.
Yeah. You know, and he made a point, but there was a study I saw recently that validates the flip side of the point that he made, too. Remember, he talked about Tom Von Essen, who was a fire commissioner. By the way, he's a really nice guy. We had dinner with him one time. But he talked about Tom Von Essen talking to Giuliani, saying it makes a real point when you take a 10-minute break and there's 5 NPCs, right? And the flip side of that dynamic is the research is showing that when you let a few people perform under par, is you screw up the high performance, right? And so, I mean, it's a different way of looking at the same thing, right? Because what has a tendency to happen, it's like the studies with pay. There was an article I saw on Whole Foods just a couple days ago where they publish every employee's pay. So if you're an employee and you want to see what your boss makes, you go online and just see what everybody's getting paid. And that's a real smart move because, again, all the studies show if I don't know what everybody else is making, I always assume I'm getting undercompensated, they're getting overcompensated. And I have an inflated idea of what my boss is making. And by the way, as an owner-operator, your employees always have a massively inflated idea of what you're making, right? If the average instructor doesn't look at your facility and go, $9,000 a month in rent. They go, I'm paying $1,000 a month for my apartment. This is probably about the same. Right? You know? They don't go, wow, you know, they spent more double in advertising this month than my salary. I mean, you know, they just...
What they think is if your school grosses $30,000, that you put $30,000 in your pocket. Even though they know you're paying their salary and they know you do have summer in, they know why. But hey, we grossed $30,000. They think $30,000. They don't worry about taxes either. It doesn't. $30,000 goes in their pocket.
No, that's exactly right. You're close to it, right?
Yeah.
And that's why I was always as completely transparent as I could possibly think to be. Eric, the rent was the utility bill. You know, I would share the utility bill, the phone bill, all that kind of stuff, right? Because if you don't, then it doesn't do you any good to keep it behind the curtain because they underestimate. Just like the salaries, they overestimate what everybody else is making. But the point of holding accountable is it really is interesting because, again, the surest way to kill the top performers is to tolerate the poor performers. Because they're like, well, if it's okay for them, why am I breaking my balls, right? Why am I working so hard? So if, and you've always got to completely discriminate among staff, and I'm not talking about male, female, white, black, whatever. Performance gets rewarded. Lack of performance gets penalized, right? So my version of that was always level of freedom. People who are putting big numbers on the board, they had a lot of flexibility on when they showed up, what they did, how, all that. Now they couldn't, you know, wear different uniform, but you know, if you just had a $60,000 a month and you want to take a 3-day weekend, hey, you know, don't ask me, just you know, go do it as long as you're keeping the numbers up. On the other hand, if your numbers were low, I was micromanaging, right? So if you wanted the sure way to have me with the, you know, up your ass and micromanaging, have low numbers, but you have to, right? It's like your checklist thing. The guys who aren't performing, you got to go figure out what they're missing. So you've got to do the checklist of, you know, you're supposed to be at 3 o'clock, it was 3:05, what the hell, right? The guy who's doing, you know, you just had a $20,000 night last night, you're a little tired today, you slept in and came in just for the intros, no problem.
You know what I found funny is the guys who were doing really well were never had a problem doing the checklist. They made sure they usually made sure they had staff doing the checklist.
Right.
They made sure they were always done, and they actually used the checklist to manage them, so it was no problem. And the ones who were doing well, they would come to me with an argument about why they shouldn't have to do the checklist all the time. Or they'd come to me with a way that it was going to be easier for them to do, or they'd laminate it, just have one copy. We made them actually do a copy every night so we knew that they did it and we did it. You know, and they would come up with some, it's like they spent time trying to figure some other thing instead of just doing the damn job.
Right.
And reinventing it. And a lot of times we spend time doing that.
They would put more effort figuring out how to get around the system than it would take to do it.
These alibis, not alibis instead of achievement.
Yeah.
But that's, it doesn't matter, you know, if you don't have multiple schools, you're not having the issue with having, if you're there and you're dealing with it, the poor performers are still within, you know, they could be one of the instructors that's not doing well, or one of the instructors that's not, if they're coming in wrong, we've got to be really, really consistent about fixing at least the minimum level expectations.
Or your staff with your lead follow-up and things like that, which is major, and all your phone calls and that kind of thing. You have it broken down separately.
Yeah, that's important to automate as much as you can.
The exception to what you said a minute ago, I think, is Peter Drucker's line was strong people always have strong weaknesses, right? And what I would find happening in our company is I would find like the office staff trying to turn my best instructor or best salesperson into a good accountant, right? And I'd much rather go hire somebody to clean up after the guy than to try to, because the personality type to have the best marketer salesperson is usually the opposite of detail-oriented, like, you remember Mike Harrison. This guy, like, would periodically lose checks. I mean, $5,000-$10,000 checks, right? I finally put a drop safe in the office and said, Mike, here's the deal. When you get a $10,000 check, just drop it in the safe there, and we'll worry about it afterwards. Now, was I going to fire him? No, I wasn't going to fire him because like, he was the only one having $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 a night, right? But I had to figure out a way to keep him from losing the checks when he got it because of the pain in the ass to go track the person down and get him to, you know, give us another check.
Or figure out what they were paying or who it was or anything.
Yeah, exactly. But you do have to stick with that. Strong people have strong weaknesses. So don't, and again, it's... is it Covey who says, don't let things that matter least, you know, be it, don't let things that matter most be at the mercy of the things that matter least, right? So they don't have to be perfect, they just have to be really good at the things that matter.
Yeah, don't mistake that, though, that if somebody's pretty weak in a lot of areas, you just hire people. The stuff they don't like doing, you just hire people to fix it all.
No.
If somebody's
that's a different thing.
And strong, yeah, then it's not a problem. I think a lot of us in this room are that way. You probably should be paying somebody to do your yard work. Or you probably should be, because you're paying $20 an hour for somebody to do your yard work, or $50 an hour for somebody to do your yard work. But if you're at your school during that time, or taking that time off to recharge so that you can be stronger at your school, you might be better off. And
well, and there may be a lot of business activities. I mean, to me, the indication is always the stuff that pisses me off to have to do. Oftentimes were the things that I could most easily delegate, right? Like, anything that has to do with sales taxes or the IRS absolutely pisses me off to high heaven. I'm just in a mood fit to be tight. But see, that's easy to delegate. You know, you go get the payroll company, you get the accounting company, you get the person who comes and looks over their shoulders, and all you have to do is, like, occasionally sign something. I get the shake signing it, but, you know, at least they don't have to touch it, right? But I'll talk to people who are, like, so proud of doing all their own accounting or something. It's like,
oh, my God. Yeah. Or their billing. I've never found, in fact, Master Munch Billing was doing his own billing for a while, and then he just went back to having somebody else do it. It's usually never cost effective to do that. Now, with the software people have, sometimes that's not true. But for a long time, it was just, you know, same thing. I'm doing my own billing. Well, yeah, but it takes you 10 hours a week to do that. Or it only takes me 3 hours a week or a month. But it's 3 hours, and you're not doing any marketing. You need to do the marketing. Somebody else can do the billing. You're the only one that can really do the marketing. So you have to do that. And somehow that's the big one, that the marketing time ends up getting sucked up by all kinds of other
activities. All kinds of BS,
that you could delegate. And so there's always a reason. Well, you know, and can I tell a quick story about that? Did I tell one about being in South America and marketing time last time? Well, I was teaching at the South America camp I just came back from, and it was a few years ago. I go there every year. And there were 200 schools represented there. And out of 200 schools, they probably taught, you know, I don't know, 30-some classes. We figured out they taught 186,000 classes that year. And I asked them, well, how many hours should you market every week? And they said, some people said 5 hours a week. Some people said 20 hours a week. I said, okay, well, let's say 10 hours a week. Well, how many hours did you really market? And they said, oh, well, you really need a couple hours a week. So they missed 80% of the time they should have been marketing as a collective group. They have the same issues we do over here. They got to be out and do stuff or do something to market. 80% of the time they miss. Out of 186,000 classes, how many do you think they actually miss? Other than like a holiday or something where they're closed. How many do you think?
Close to not much.
There were three. One guy had a hurricane and he missed two classes. A hurricane. So he couldn't actually physically get to the school. The other guy, like, his car broke and whatever, and he was one class late. 186,000 classes, and they missed three. Three in the whole continent. So that was 0.0003% that they missed. But they missed 80% of marketing. Why do you think they missed the marketing and not the instruction?
It's not their favorite
one. That's what everybody says. But I don't believe that at all, because some days you guys don't feel like teaching class. I do not believe that one bit, that, oh, they love teaching so much, they would only miss 0.002%.
You're going to have students show up for the classes.
Exactly. People are going to bitch at them if they don't show up for the classes. They're going to get yelled at. They're going to have major problems. But if you don't do your marketing, the only ones bitching at you really is us. So that's probably one of the big things you pay us for. And we should be getting on you about that, or at least bitching is probably a strong word.
Maybe a wife, husband, girlfriend, when there's not money in the end of the month.
Yeah, right. Well, they bitch because there's no money. And so sometimes then you cut your marketing because you want to lower your expenses. And it's the opposite thing. When really what's happening is, you know, the marketing should be just as important. Otherwise, you don't have students to teach. Yeah, this is our... Okay. But you know, think about that. 186,000 classes taught and only a tiny bit were missed. And that's what we do all the time.
If we're going to be in this room tomorrow, I'd go buy a doorstop or something.
Yeah. This is, like, really strange.
Yeah.
We're in the other room tomorrow, though, right?
We're back in the Eisenhower room,
which is an even nicer room.
Yeah.
I did have a question.
Except that door, everything has a door issue. Because that door is like a dungeon, you know? Like,
yeah.
I think that West Point must use it for cadets when they don't behave and they've got to...
Can I tell you the secret? There is another door that's just right there.
No, it's not the same. I mean, it's better than a big door.
Makes you feel macho.
I guess, yeah.
It's like the big, yeah.
It's awesome. It does, right? You guys have used it. It's true. We'll take a photo.
What do you say to let someone else handle the billing? how does that relate to the financial side to it? I feel it's really important that I stay on top of the payments that are coming in
right.
from our students and things like that.
Yeah, but the manual labor to do the billing, the manual labor to make sure the list is there, make sure, you know, you got to check your billing to make sure they do the stuff that they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
But that's a lot less work than tracking them down. It depends on what you're doing.
It's a delegate abdicate conversation, right? Is really, you're never going to be able to, in the foreseeable future anyway, automate or outsource the making the sale, right? Enrollment renewal. And you're not going to be able to outsource the teaching, right? if it becomes enough virtual reality that people just sit at home in their living room and take their lesson, don't go to a school, we all have problems, right? But I can't imagine that happening because most of it is social and so forth. But there's all kinds of administrative stuff that can be done better and cheaper by somebody else. And if it's a generic function like running payroll and so forth, you know, there's big companies that do that. And if it's a function
Let me say something on payroll. You should have those companies do it. Don't do it yourself. Because it protects you from having problems later.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've made some mistakes on that before.
Well, the payroll is where everybody gets in trouble.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
Now the IRS deposit doesn't get made, and I owed them $168,000 one time, right? And I used to have framed in my office the certificate that they sent me when it was paid to zero, right? But everybody gets in trouble with that. So all of a sudden you're a little cash short.
You will if you do it yourself, so don't do it yourself.
Yeah, all of a sudden you're a little cash short and you don't make your tax deposit, or you make a mistake, and it starts aggregating, and then you figure it out a year or two later, and then it's penalties and interest and so forth. I was on a cruise one time, and the IRS took $5,000 out of my account. That was like 1986. And it must have taken 6 months to figure out what it was even for. You know, have you ever tried calling the IRS or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
You call the IRS, and they say the burden of proof is on the taxpayer to prove that you don't know it. Well, what was it for? Well, you know, you owe, okay. Well, and what it turned out to be is, I don't even know how we figured it out. A tax deposit for like $30,000. And we were running big payrolls, right? So it was like a $30,000 payroll tax deposit was deposited 7 days late, right? That's why you want all the electronic stuff in. So by time the penalty for 7 days late, plus the interest on 7 days.
I'm getting anxiety you talking about this, man.
When 2.5 years, that was then, right? I mean,
it could be like 3-4 times the amount.
Yeah.
I don't even want to.
It's a ridiculous.
I'm not telling any of my stories because I don't want to.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. No. You know my funniest Tom Callis story? My funniest Tom Callis story. It's not the funniest one, but it's probably the funniest one I can tell.
Yeah.
Okay. But Tom was having some tax problems years ago when he had, you know, very successful school in Reno a long time ago, doing nothing that he would tell anybody to do now. But Ned Muffley of EFC had called it. And it's like the 25th or 26th of the month when everything's closed out. And so Ned picks up the phone and leaves a message for Tom. And, of course, it's Eastern time to Pacific time. And says on Tom's voicemail, Tom, well, the good news is your collections were $32,383 this month. The bad news is the IRS levied it, and we sent it all to them. Okay.
Oh,
now, Ned was doing that as a joke.
Oh, this is not funny.
No, it was not funny. Tom Callis down there had a heart attack, and I mean, he's having a nervous breakdown. And you know, and Ned let it go 24 hours before telling him it was a joke. So,
that's harsh.
And Ned told me about an hour after he said it, and I said, that's just mean. I'm going to call him and tell him. That's just mean. I can't believe he did that. But
you didn't call him and tell him. You let him wait 24 hours.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about this story.
If I remember correctly, I tried and didn't get a living or something.
Oh, tried really hard. There weren't cell phones then. You didn't have cell phone coverage then.
I didn't have any reason at all then to be irritated with Tom. It wasn't until they became a green neck, beast neck, fuzzy headed, giving everybody the wrong advice about how to run school that started. We're still good friends, but. Yeah, you know, it's basically whatever he says about running a school, do the opposite and you'll be a pretty successful. Yeah. Okay, any other quick lessons from Commissioner Carrick?
Let me just say, I was going to add on, you know, the billing thing was just one thing we talked about, but anything you can delegate is, and I think a good point is stuff you don't like doing. I mean, not the sales.
I've talked to a bunch of people who didn't get their marketing done this week because they had to redecorate the school. And we had one of our newest franchisees. We're sitting there, and they haven't got all the marketing done because they're bogged down in the accounting, and they're bogged down in all this stuff. And my comment to them was, if you didn't look at anything that's distracting you from marketing, because all you need is 100 new students, if you didn't look at anything that's distracting you from marketing until January, there is no crisis that's going to happen, right? But you've got to get the marketing done. You've got 100, need to have 100 new students. And anything else that you're just being distracted on, tell yourself you can deal with it on December 28th.
Well, and I would use the same example of the teaching. You know, if the toilet overflowed and something happened and you had to fix it and it got in your way, you deal with it and you still get the classes taught. Well, the marketing's got to be the same priority. It can't be a different priority.
Well, you can't be painting the school yourself, cleaning the bathrooms yourself.
Or if you really think you need to paint the school on the weekend, but you've got to add more time. I mean, if you're going to do the work, I would rather pay somebody to do that. You know, it doesn't make sense for you to do stuff. That's a good example of something where, you know, we could all paint a building. I mean, I'm sure we've all painted rooms before. We could all do it.
I worked my way through college for 2 years painting.
Yeah, I mean, we've all, right? Is everybody not painted a house, painted a room or something, got the roller out and done that? Okay, everybody's done that, right?
Don't ever do it again.
Yeah, don't ever do it again. I mean, pay somebody else to do that. There's people, and if you find the right price, it's cheaper than you can do because you'll screw it up. Not really, maybe. I don't want to say everybody. I would screw it up. Definitely I would screw it up.
It's like me and car repairs.
It's like what?
Me and car repairs. Did I tell you about the time I blew out the nav system and the stereo and the Porsche?
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
You know, I'm like Porsche.
Work on 911 all the time.
What's that?
Work on the Mercedes.
Okay. Any other last thoughts from Commissioner Carrick or any questions related to that? No? Okay. Let's leave it with this. Is tomorrow we'll do a lot of renewal blitz information. Simon, we're going to have it all recorded, so we'll get it accessible pretty quickly. We're going to do at least two, if not three, calls on renewal blitz. But I really want to anchor in just to finish to whine a little bit more about something that we did over here. Whichever sheet it was. And we don't have Paul to kick around anymore today, so. No.
Sorry. Oh, it's okay. Weak ladders got money.
At least it's not me. Okay, here we go. Let's run a number, a really easy number, right? And again, let's take, we were using 200 active because that was Greg and Jan, a couple of others, active count. At 200 active, if you're charging $150 versus 200. Now, and of course, that could be 145 or 149. This could be 197. But let's just put it in ratio, okay? And so if you're doing 200 active students and you're grossing $30,000 a month, okay, and you went from about 150 a month to 200 a month for doing what? How much did you add to the gross?
$10,000.
Everybody see where that came from? I mean, that's a 33% increase from 150, right?
you know, you don't go the other way. It's not a 25% increase, it's a 33% increase. So a 33% increase going from 150 to 200 is adds a third to the gross. In other words, it would, in this ratio, would add 10,000 directly to the gross. What additional expenses come out of that additional 10,000? Anybody? Payroll. Because you should have payroll of people who are being paid as a percentage, right? But other than payroll, so, you know, in my ratio, it would be I've got 2,500 in additional payroll, which, by the way, is it better for me to pay them more money or is it better for me to pay them less money? Better for me to pay them more money. Why? They're happier, they can buy more cool stuff, their wife, girlfriend, husband, boyfriend bitches less, right? I mean, go on down the line. It's a better world for me if I can afford to pay them more money. I just can't afford to pay them more money out of the same gross, because then the profit margin, which may not have been that great to begin with, really goes down, right? But if I can go from here to here, literally I added 10,000 in gross with only the difference in payroll percentage as an additional expense, 7,500 pure net. Now, it's quite likely that at 30,000 a month, the net was about 7,500. So what did you just do? You just doubled the net, right? Because keep in mind, I mean, we're in a business where you have mostly fixed expenses. And so an incremental increase in the gross has a big impact on the net. Does that make sense? Okay? So if you look at this, you know, just the ones with the red check mark, every one of you could add 33% to the gross by doing nothing. And I mean nothing more than just make the initial tuition this rather than the initial tuition this or this. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. And that's a really big lesson. Don't miss the fact that that incremental increase in revenue has a doubling effect on the bottom line. Right? I mean, that's big. Because again, I mean, every school is going to be different, but it's easy to run a school at $30,000 that's netting $7,500, $10,000. But then if you add another $10,000 to the gross, you double or almost double the net, then that's a big difference. Right? Second, the same thing is true over here. Right? So if you go over here and you look at these numbers, again, my rule of thumb is, and I've seen it work just fine over and over and over again, whatever this number is, your higher level upgrade can be double or more. And if you have a fallback that's somewhere in between, that keeps this from pricing too many people out of the market and having to drop out, right? That's the only reason I want a fallback. Because really, in the sales process, they'll all want to do this. But some of them, if you push this heavy enough, you've priced them out of the market, right? And again, if you talk to some of you about your upgrades, well, I only have one thing, and everybody does that, and it's no problem. Well, what does that mean? You're not charging enough, right? Because you want to push it to the point where some people can't afford it, right? And so on this number...
Sir, wait a minute. Are you saying if somebody has one program just the first time or one upgrade?
Oh, one upgrade.
Because we have some other people that just have one program, and that right. means your base rate, you know, like they're charging $200 for leadership, and they're real excited about that. I say, well, that's great, but you could charge $200 for some A program, a basic program, and you could get $400 for leadership. So it's just.
Oh, like, yeah, well, you're talking about the schools who are like day one enrolling them directly into leadership.
Right.
And see, the challenge with that is, with a little bit of prep and a little bit of hand-holding, a little bit more elongated introductory process and an expanded product, once they really trust you and are there, you can have a big jump. But yeah. It's very rare to be able to accomplish that at one lesson or at two lessons.
Yeah, I don't think there's much of a case. I don't think that if you tested this, you'd ever find that whatever you could sell program day one for, day one or two, however you do the first lesson, is going to be varied much by offering more stuff or more product or more something or more anything. It's just whatever price you can, you know, that market's going to bear. So if you're getting 200, you're getting 200. You could sell even a simpler program, you'd still get 200.
I don't
think there's a whole lot of, here's all the extra bells and whistles.
Because they don't even appreciate it at that.
Yeah, it's not like a car where you, everybody knows what cars are. So if you got the run flat tires and the thing and the thing and the tinted windows and stuff, you kind of, you guys already know what that is, but none of our new clients know any of that stuff. So if you told them you're getting the super fancy this or that, it doesn't
And the
matter.
500 horsepower AMG
yeah.
version.
So if I was going to do the 200 and that's what I wanted because I didn't want to do sales, I didn't want to do this, yeah. I wouldn't do any extra stuff. I would just teach something really simple.
Yeah.
I'd make it really, everything super simple. You know, but that's the opposite momentum people are going in. So
right.
that one's not good. And if you don't have the middle program, I think the other advantage is you're giving people an A-B choice. It's
yeah.
not even the fallback, too, but I think the upgrade numbers are going to go up because you have an A-B choice, not a yes or no choice.
Yeah.
Well, I mostly think of it as I can push the envelope enough on price that if I've pushed it just so far that it's out of 25% of the people's budget or even 50% of the people's budget, I still have something that gets them to that level without having to flush them out.
Okay, so there's two good reasons, maybe even three or four,
yeah.
to have a kind of this three level approach.
Right.
So excuse me. So how do you present that in a upgrade conference? You present the higher level program first, and then what did they say? You don't want to think about it.
I will in almost all cases present that they're both. But spend all my time on why the leadership program is the way to go.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
So like even if you watch that video, is, you know, I'm saying, you know, they learn how to be a good student and a good independent self-starter, and then they learn small group leadership and a large group, and you know, do you want this or do you want all of it? And almost always they'll say, we want the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's the leadership program. And then you go all the way through the process, but then if you hit a roadblock on price, right? Which, I mean, there's a lot of other ways to fix that, but having that fallback so it's not as much of a jump, right? But again, I mean, seeing over and over and over again that this can be a 50% bump, and this can be double. And the folly I see a lot is they're doing 150, 160, 170, or 150, 165, 175, or something like that. And that becomes a why bother, right?
I 100% agree,
yeah.
Why bother?
Yeah. I mean, why have an elite program that's another $10 a month, right? So again, I mean, think about the leverage you have. So if you currently have an upgrade that's, say, $197 a month, see, there's a couple of those, or $300 a month, $245. See, what's the leverage of it becomes $397 or even more than that, right? See, so if you look at this versus this, well, that's an extra $200 a month. How quickly does that add up? How much of that difference is profit? All of it except for what else you pay the staff, right? And again, this is the way you go from running even high volume, low profit school to same volume, very profitable school. Does that make sense to everybody? And again, this isn't hypothetical. I can't tell you how many times with some of the leaders in the industry, you know, I've sat down with P&Ls and gone through and looked at it, and some of the ones that look best, you know, from a distance, when you get into the numbers, it's like, well, God, you know, it'd be nice to have something left over at the end of the day, right? And so, and again, Covarns, I've done that with a bunch of times over the years, La Valley, I can go through a whole bunch of others. But you want to get that leverage so that you have net profit at the end of the day. And the problem with doing it the opposite way, right? If you take this scenario, and now I want to jump the revenue by going to 300 active, 400 active at the same price point. What happens to your expenses now? See, your expenses increase as the student body increases, right? And it's not even linear. Because at a certain point, you need more square footage, and it jumps a lot. You need another person, and it jumps a lot. And I've seen a bunch of million-dollar-a-year schools that weren't cash flowing any money, you know? And guess what? Those are complicated operations that are a pain in the ass to run, that have all kinds of things that can go wrong, that create a bad lifestyle for the owner-operator or the manager, because there's so many different moving pieces, right? You didn't meet with him, but the guy we met with in San Diego. See, I don't want a school with 800 active at $75 a month. I don't know how to make money doing that, right?
I wouldn't want to make money doing that, because it's so much more work and so much more stress on the staff, and you get one instructor that, I mean, you might be able to generate
more. He had 19 instructors.
Yeah. That's the same problem we've got with the Chester's thing, is he's only got two instructors, but their system is built around somebody who has like 15 instructors on the floor all the time. So you can't operate in normal cases. That's a different discussion about curriculum instead of.
Well, it's the same conversation we were having yesterday about Greg. Greg's school. You know, if you haven't systematized the curriculum in such a way you can manage it, haven't systematized the class schedule, it's what I always hated about the designing a school that doesn't need it to have two classrooms going at the same time. Right? I mean, that's not talking about, you know, in your case, you got Muay Thai and then you got Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and you need that. But a lot of like traditional schools, all of a sudden they're doing two different classrooms, two different class schedules. The class schedules overlapped. You needed to have.
And I did that and I would never do that again.
Yeah, I did too.
In your case, you're running three schools.
Yeah. It just happens to be in one building. In Paul's case, he's running two schools in the same building.
Or two businesses, because he's got the opposite.
Yeah, two completely different businesses. That's exactly right. But again, just to leave you with this food for thought, this highest level program really should be about double. And highest level is the wrong way to say it. Your leadership program should be about double. And again, why I caught myself is there can certainly be something else out here that's a lot higher, right? I believe a lot of you are well positioned to have the $1,000 a month program, okay? I wouldn't pick that exact number, $997 a month, $1,297 a month. But again, I mean, you guys, you could easily have 50 people paying, you know, $1,200 a month or something. And again, as long as you structured it right, that's mostly profits, right? So, but again, there's a lot of leverage to incremental change here. And there's a lot of leverage to moving this higher. And again, the way you can rationalize it for yourself is if you want to have your fallback be whatever it is you're charging now, fine. Just have the next thing out here, right? So if you're normally, like, let's take this number, whoever it was, 245. Okay, so you're now doing the higher program is 245, fine. Make the leadership 397 and have the fallback 245, because you're already doing whatever ratio you're doing at 245. So you know that many people, every time you do a renewal, can afford 245. You're not going to lose them, right? You already have the ones that didn't renew at 245, didn't renew at all. It's not going to make any difference to them. But then, in fact, I would argue you'll get a higher percentage. But if you stick with that as a fallback and then put the new higher thing, guess what's going to really happen? All of a sudden, half of them are doing the new higher thing, or 60% are doing the new higher thing, or 70% are doing the new higher thing. Does that make sense? Okay. And I guess the only thing that I would add to that before we call it a night, think in terms of this is 75% plus of everybody who enrolls, upgrades to some level. And if you're not hitting that number, then there's a big gap there too, okay? And it's not because it's Muay Thai or Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or Taekwondo or Shotokan, it's because your system isn't in place to get it to happen, right? Typically, the biggest problem is you enroll them, throw them over the wall, and in a couple months try to pull them back out in class and sell them something. That doesn't work very well. You've got to walk them through the process from day one, set them up to think properly about the program from day one, and then it works like a charm.
And that's another good reason not to delay the upgrade so long. Because the longer you delay the upgrade, the more the process is hard to control. if you wait like 3 months or 4 months now, you know, then you're, it really is like you're pulling it back over the wall and doing it. But if you're doing it, we start in 2 weeks. We have a progress check, and then we, you know, but we do a bunch of stuff before then. So there's, but if I had to do that stuff for 3 months, I would, there's no way to track it or manage it, or the guys would just, it'd be a mess. Yeah, I was going to say something too, sir, if it's okay.
Go ahead.
You know, there's a couple ways to implement a new pricing system like this. I mean, one way, you know, if you've got, you take a lot of steps and you've got, you're presenting this price, whatever you're doing, and then you say, well, you know, next week, next month, I'm going to go to 147 and 207. And then the next time I'm going to go, you know, I'm going to make a bunch of steps. The way you probably all ought to do it is you ought to pull up the whatever file you have on your computer tonight that has whatever pricing you're doing, and just delete it, and then put the new things in, and then we'll start it. And you might start it after the blitz. You might use this as the blitz as a way to integrate this, which I like. But if we were talking 3 months ago, I'd say don't wait for the blitz. Just do it now.
Say it the same way, is you can have a new price on this Monday.
Yeah, Monday, exactly.
Right.
On
so
the
next
first
new
level program.
Do, yeah.
Exactly. There's no reason to wait. I mean, you could change that right now. And you could just look at this list, and I think, you know, and I don't want to insult anybody's style or over-exaggerate how good another style is, but it doesn't seem like it seems to matter if you're Shotokan or Karate or Taekwondo or Jiu-Jitsu or anything, that these pricing still seem to be pretty consistent. I mean, have we found anybody that can charge more than another? If
no.
you're doing cardio kickboxing, it might be harder to charge $399 a month.
No, we've had a few $300 a month.
So none of it. Yeah. So there's been no, in all the experience that we've had, no data to suggest that
I think different segments of our market come with a better or worse preconditioned peer group. And so what we all have a tendency to do is, if I'm an MMA school, I look what the other MMA schools are doing. If I'm a Taekwondo school,
right.
I look at what the Taekwondo schools are doing. And in general terms, the more traditional schools started evolving a lot longer. You know, it's been a lot longer since they started evolving than the MMA and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu schools. So if there's a skew, it's that some of the schools in different niches are predisposed to doing it a different way.
Well, like I just did with cardio kickboxing. I just did that myself, and so that's my dream. But the point is that you guys could. I mean, one way to think is, what's the largest one that somebody charges on this list, and all of you guys could just, like, Monday, do it that way?
Yeah, right now it's $229 for a new enrollment.
Okay, so there you go, Monday.
Yeah.
So, Carol, you're doing that, $229. You could just do that Monday, and there's not really any data to suggest that anybody would have a lower conversion rate. I mean, other than your own psychology, that's the only thing that seems to be the major effect.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and the only caveat is, don't just go tell your program director, start doing it that way. If you're a single school and you have somebody else doing the sale, go do the sale yourself for the first five or ten, and then show them, and then tell them, and then hand it off. I've seen that mistake where they go, and all of a sudden their closing rate goes from 75% to zero. And it's just the guy selling doesn't believe it. And doesn't have anything to do with anything other than he doesn't believe it, so therefore you're screwed up. Does that make sense? Okay, so anything to leave with for the end of the day? Did everybody enjoy having Commissioner Carrick here? So I think he was trying real hard in some cases to make the stretch from what's the leadership lesson in 54,000 employees and the leadership lesson with 5.4 employees, right? And so all the same principles are in place, but what we've all got to replicate is what he had, which is a whole list of bench strength and other people that were coming up, because that's the only gap in being able to have that accountability for us, as far as I can see. Well, good. We're what time do we say tomorrow?
9:00.
Okay. 9:00 next door in the Eisenhower. We were planning on going about 9 to 3 tomorrow. The Eisenhower room is the one next door with the heavy door.